whetted the thirst somewhat, but they did not end it. The best of the half-measures lay in killing a living animal and drinking its blood still warm from its body. It was the life, you see, the life as well as the blood itself. Through all of this, I protected myself. I moved about England several times, so the deaths and disappearances of my victims would not be concentrated in one locale. I buried as many bodies as I could, and I finally began to apply my intellect to my hunting. I needed money, so I sought out wealthy prey. I became rich, and then richer. Money breeds more money, and once I had some, more came to me honestly, cleanly. I had become quite fluent in English by then. I changed my name again, styled myself a gentleman, bought myself an isolated house on the moors in Scotland, where my behavior would draw little attention, hired some discreet servants. Each month I went away on business, always overnight. None of my prey lived anywhere near me. The servants suspected nothing. Finally I hit upon what I thought might be the answer. One of my servants, a pretty young maid, had been growing more and more familiar with me. She seemed to like me, and not simply as an employer. I returned her affection. She was honest, cheerful, and quite intelligent, if uneducated. I began to think of her as my friend, and I saw in her a way out. Often I had considered the alternative of chaining myself up, or otherwise confining myself, until the red thirst had passed, but I had never hit on a scheme to make it work. If I put the key in reach, I would use it when the thirst was on me. If I tossed it away, how would I get unchained? No, I needed the help of another. But I had always heeded my father's warning to trust none of you with my secret. Now I decided to take a risk. I dismissed my other servants and sent them away, hired no one to replace them. I had a room built in my house, a small windowless room with thick stone walls and an iron door as thick as I remembered from the cell I'd shared with my father. It could be secured from the outside with three great metal bolts. I would have no way out. When it was complete, I called my pretty little maid in and gave her instructions. I did not trust her sufficiently to tell her the full truth. I was afraid, Abner, that if she knew what I truly was, she would denounce me, or flee at once, and the solution that seemed so close at hand would be gone, along with my house and property and the life I had built. So I told her only that a brief madness came on me each month, a fit such as epilepsy brings on. During my fits, I said, I would enter my special room, and she must bolt me in and keep me there for 3 full days. I would take food and water in with me, including some live chickens, to take some of the edge off the thirst. She was shocked, concerned, and quite puzzled, but at last she agreed to do as I bid her. She loved me in her way, I think, and was willing to do almost anything for my sake. So I entered the room, and she locked the door behind me. And the thirst came. It was frightening. Despite the lack of windows, I could feel when day had come and gone. I slept by day, as always, but the nights were a blur of horror. I killed all the chickens the first night, gorged on them. I demanded to be set free, and my loyal maid refused. I screamed abuse at her. Then I simply screamed, incoherent sounds like an animal. I threw myself at the walls, pounded against the door until my fists were bloody, then squatted to suck at my own blood eagerly. I tried to claw through the soft stone, but I could not get out. On the third day, I grew clever. It was as if my fever had broken. I was on the downhill side now, becoming myself again. I could feel the thirst waning. I called my maid to the door and told her it was over, that she could let me out. She refused and said I told her to keep me confined for 3 full nights. As indeed I had. I laughed and admitted that was true, but said the fit had come and gone, that I knew it would not come again for another month. Still, she would not unbar the door. I did not rave at her. I said I understood, praised her for following orders so well. I asked her to stay and talk, since I was lonely in my prison, She agreed, and we talked for almost an hour. I was calm and articulate, charming even, very reconciled to another night inside. We spoke so reasonably that soon she admitted that I sounded quite like myself. I told her what a good girl she was to be so conscientious. I enlarged on her merits and my affection for her. Finally, I asked her to marry me when I was free again. She opened the door. She looked so happy, Abner. So very happy and alive. She was full of life. She came to kiss me, and I put my arms around her and pulled her to me. We kissed several times. Then my lips trailed down her neck, and I found the artery and opened it. I fed for a long time. I was so thirsty, and her life was so sweet. But when I let her go and she staggered back from me, she was still alive, just barely, bled white and dying, but still conscious. The look in her eyes, Abner, the look in her eyes. Of all the things I have ever done, that was the most terrible. She will be with me always. The look in her eyes. Afterward, my despair was boundless. I tried to kill myself. I bought a silver knife with a handle fashioned in the shape of a cross. The superstitions still had a grip on me, you see, and I cut my wrists open and lay down in a warm bath to die. I healed. I fell on my sword in the manner of the ancient Romans. I healed. I was learning more of my abilities every day. I mended so quickly with only a brief time of pain. My blood clotted virtually instantaneously, no matter how gaping the wound I inflicted. Whatever I might be, I was clearly a wonder. Finally, I hit on a way. Outside my house, I attached two great iron chains to the wall. By night, I donned the manacles and threw the key as far as I was able. A very long way. I waited for the dawn. The sun was worse than I remembered. It burned and blinded me. Everything blurred. My skin was on fire. I think I began to scream. I know I closed my eyes. I was out there for hours, closer and closer to death. There was nothing in me except guilt. And then, somehow, in the fever of my death, I decided to live. How, why, I cannot tell you, but it seemed to me that I had always loved life in myself and in others. That was why health and beauty and youth drew me so. I loathed myself because I gave death to the world, and yet here I was, killing once more, though this time the victim was myself. I could not wash out my sins with more blood, more death, I thought. To atone, I must live, bring life and beauty and hope back into the world, to take the place of all that I had taken. I remembered my father's vanished servants then. There were others of my race in the world. Vampires, werewolves, warlocks, whatever they might be, they were out there in the night. How did they deal with the red thirst, I wondered? If only I could find them. I could trust my own kind, where I could not trust humans. We could help each other conquer the evil that consumed us. I could learn from them. I decided I would not die. The chains were very strong. I had seen to that, fearful that I would seek escape from pain and death. But now I found a strength in my resolve greater than anything I had ever known, even when the thirst was driving me on. I determined to break the chains, to pull them from the stone walls where I had fastened them. I pulled and strained and yanked. They would not give. They were strong chains. I had been in the sun for hours and hours. What kept me conscious, I cannot say. My skin was black and burned. The pain had grown so terrible I scarcely felt it anymore. Still, I worked at those chains. Finally, one of them broke free, the left. The ring set into the wall came out in a crumble of masonry. I was half free, but I was sick unto death, having strange visions. I knew I would faint soon, and once I slipped to the ground, there would be no getting up again, ever. And the right chain seemed as strong and secure as when I had begun my struggle an endless time before. The chain never gave, Abner. Yet I won free, and sought the safety of my cool black cellars, where I lay for more than a week, dreaming and burning and writhing in pain, but healing all the while. I turned on myself, you see. I gnawed through my own wrist and left my right hand lying there while I slipped the stump through the manacle. When I regained consciousness a week later, I had a hand again. It was soft and small, half-formed, and it hurt. It hurt terribly. But in time the skin hardened. Then the hand swelled up, and the skin cracked and split, oozing a thick, pale fluid. When it dried and peeled away, the flesh beneath was healthier. 3 times that happened. The process took more than 3 weeks. But when it was over, you would never have known that anything had happened to my hand at all. I was astounded. That was in the year 1812, which marked a turning point in my life. When I had recovered my strength, I found I had emerged from the ordeal with a great resolve to change my way of life and that of my people, to free us from what my father had called the bane of the red thirst, to enable us to restore the life and beauty we drank from the world. To do this, I had first to seek out others of my kind, and the only others I knew of were my father's vanished servants. Yet a search for them was not possible just then. England warred on the empire of the French, and there was no commerce between the two. The enforced delay did not trouble me. I knew I had all the years I might require. As I waited, I took up the study of medicine. Nothing was known of my people, of course. Our very existence was legend. But there was much to learn of your race, so like and yet unlike my own. I befriended a number of doctors, a leading surgeon of the time, several faculty members of a well-known medical school. I read medical texts, old and new. I delved into chemistry, biology, anatomy, even alchemy, searching for insights. I built my own laboratory for experimentation in the very room I had once used as my ill-fated prison. Now, when I took a life, as I did each month, I would carry the body back with me whenever I could, study it, dissect it. How I yearned for a cadaver of my own species, Abner, so I might see the differences. In my 2nd year of study, I cut a finger from my left hand. I knew it would regenerate. I wanted flesh of my flesh for analysis and dissection. A severed finger was not sufficient to answer 1/100th of my questions, but the pain was nonetheless worthwhile for what I learned. Bone, flesh, and blood all showed significant differences from the human. The blood was paler, like the flesh, and lacking several elements found in human blood. The bones, on the other hand, contained more of these elements. They were at once stronger and more flexible than human bone. Oxygen, that miracle gas of Priestley and Lavoisier, was present in blood and muscle tissue to a much greater degree than in comparable samples taken from your race. I did not know what to make of any of this, but it made me feverish with theories. It seemed to me that perhaps the lax in my blood had some relation to my drive to drink the blood of others. That month, when the thirst had come and gone and I had taken my victim, I bled myself and studied the sample. The composition of my blood had changed. Somehow I had converted the blood of my victim into my own, thickening and enriching it, at least for a time. Thereafter I bled myself daily. Study showed that my blood thinned each day. Perhaps it was when the balance reached a certain critical point that the red thirst came on, I thought. My supposition left many questions unanswered. Why was animal blood insufficient to quell the thirst, or even human blood taken from a corpse? Did it lose some property in death? Why had the thirst not come upon me until I was 20? What of all the years before? I did not know any of the answers, nor how to find them. But now, at least, I had a hope, a starting point. I began to make potions. What can I tell you of that? It took years, endless experiments, study. I used human blood, animal blood, metals and chemicals of all sorts. I cooked blood, dried it, drank it raw, mixed it with wormwood, brandy, with foul-smelling medicinal preservatives, with herbs, salts, irons. I drank 1,000 potions to no avail. Once I made myself sick, so my stomach churned and heaved until I vomited forth the concoction I had downed. Always it was fruitless. Potions and jars of blood and drugs I could consume by the hundreds, but still the red thirst drove me forth to hunt by night. I killed without guilt now, knowing that I was striving for an answer, that I would conquer my bestial nature yet. I did not despair, Abner. And finally, in the year 1815, I found my answer. Some of my mixtures had worked better than others, you see, and those I had continued to work with, improving them, making this change or addition, then that one, patiently, trying one after the other, and all the time searching out new approaches as well. The compound I finally produced had as its base sheep's blood in large measure, mixed with a strong portion of alcohol, which acted to preserve its properties, I believe. Yet that description oversimplifies vastly. There is a good part of laudanum in it as well, for calm and sweet visions, plus potassium salts and iron and wormwood, and various herbs and alchemical preparations long disused. For 3 years I had searched for it, and one night in the summer of 1815 I drank it down, as I had so many other potions before. That night the red thirst did not come upon me. The night following I felt the beginnings of the hot restlessness which marks the onset of the thirst, and I poured a glass of my drink and sipped at it, half afraid my triumph would be a dream, illusory. But the feeling faded. I did not thirst that night either, nor go abroad to hunt and kill. At once I set to work, making the fluid in large quantities. It is not always easy to get it exactly right, and if the mixture is not exact, it has no effect. My labor was painstaking, however. You have seen the result, Abner. My special drink. It is never far from me. Abner, I accomplished what none of my race had ever done before, though I did not know it then, in that hot flush of triumph. I had begun a new epoch for my people, and yours as well. Darkness without fear. An end to hunter and prey, to hiding and despair. No more nights of blood and degradation. Abner, I conquered the red thirst. I know now that I was extraordinarily fortunate. My understanding was superficial and limited. I thought the differences between our peoples lay solely in the blood. Later, I learned how wrong that was. I felt that excess of oxygen was somehow responsible for the way the fevers of the red thirst coursed through my veins. Today, I think it more likely that oxygen gives my race its strength and helps it heal. Much of what I thought I knew in 1815, I know now for nonsense. But it does not matter, for my solution was no nonsense. I have killed since, Abner, I will not deny that, but in the fashion humans kill, for human reasons. And since that night in Scotland in 1815, I had not tasted blood, or felt the ravages of the red thirst. I did not stop learning, not then or ever. Knowledge has a beauty to me, and I rejoice in all beauty, and there was still much to know of myself and my people. But with my great discovery, the emphasis of the quest changed, and I began to search for others of my race. At first, I employed agents and letters. Later, when peace had come, I traveled on the continent myself. Thus, I discovered how my father had ended. More importantly, in old provincial records, I found where he had come from, or at least where he claimed to have come from. I followed the trail through the Rhineland, through Prussia and Poland. To the Poles he was a dimly remembered, much-feared recluse their great-grandfathers had whispered about. Some said he had been a Teutonic knight. Others pointed me further east, to the Urals. It made no difference. The Teutonic knights were centuries dead, and the Urals were a great range of mountains too vast for me to search blindly. At a dead end I decided to take a risk. Wearing a great silver ring and a cross, which I hoped would be sufficient to dispel any talk or superstition, I began to inquire openly about vampires, werewolves, and other such legends. Some laughed at me or mocked me. A few crossed themselves and slunk away, but most gladly told the simple-minded Englishman the folk tales he wanted to hear, in exchange for a drink or a meal. From their stories I took directions. It was never easy. Years passed while I searched. I learned Polish, Bulgar, some Russian. I read papers in a dozen languages, looking for accounts of death that sounded like the Red Thirst. Twice I was forced to return to England to brew more of my drink and give some attention to my affairs. And finally, they found me. I was in the Carpathians, in a rude country inn. I had been asking questions, and word of my inquiries had passed from mouth to mouth. Tired and despondent, and beginning to feel the first twinges of the thirst, I had returned to my room early, well before dawn. I was sitting before a crackling fire, sipping my drink, when I heard a clatter that, at first, I thought was the storm rattling the frost-rimed windows. I turned to look. The room was dark but for the blaze in the hearth, and the window was opened from outside. And there, outlined against the blackness and the snow and the stars, was a man, standing on the sill. He came inside easy as a cat, making no noise as he landed. A cold wind whipping around him from the winter that howled outside. He was dark, but his eyes burned, Abner. They burned. "You are curious about vampires, Englishman," he whispered in passable English as he shut the window softly behind him. It was a frightening moment, Abner. Perhaps it was the chill from outside that filled the room and made me tremble, but I think not. I saw this stranger as so many of your people had seen me, before I took them and feasted on their life's blood. Dark and hot-eyed and terrible, a shadow with teeth that moved with a sure grace and spoke in a sinister whisper. As I started to rise from my chair, he moved forward into the light. I saw his nails. They were claws, grown 5 inches long, the ends black and sharp. Then I looked up and saw his face, and it was a face I had known in childhood. And as I looked on it again, the name came to me as well. "Simon," I said. He stopped. Our eyes met. "You have looked into my eyes, Abner. You have seen the power in them, I think, and perhaps other things as well, darker things. So it is with all of our race. Mesmer wrote of animal magnetism, of a strange force that resides in all living things, in some more strongly than others. I have seen this force in humans. In war, two officers may order their men to do the same foolhardy course. One will be killed for his troubles by his own troops. The second, using the same words in the same situation, will compel his men to follow him willingly and to certain death. Bonaparte had the power in great measure, I think. But our race, we have it most of all. It resides in our voices, and especially in our eyes. We are hunters, and with our eyes we can captivate and quiet our natural prey, bend them to our will, sometimes even compel them to assist in their own slaughter. I knew none of this then. All I knew was Simon's eyes, the heat of them, the rage and suspicion there. I could feel the thirst burning within him, and the sight of it woke my own long-buried bloodlust dimly, like calling to like, until I was afraid. I could not look away, nor could he. We faced each other silently, moving but slightly in a wary circle, eyes locked. My glass fell and shattered on the floor. How much time passed, I cannot say. But finally Simon looked down, and it was over. Then he did something startling and strange. He knelt before me, and bit open a vein in his own wrist so the blood flowed out, and held it up to me in submission. "Blood, master," he said in French. The flowing blood, so close at hand, woke a dryness in my throat. I reached out and grabbed his arm, trembling, and began to bend toward it. And then I remembered. I slapped him and spun away, and the bottle was on the table by the hearth. I poured two glasses, drained one, and thrust the other at him while he looked on, uncomprehending. "Drink," I commanded him, and he did as he was told. I was Bloodmaster, and my word was law. That was the beginning, there in the Carpathians in 1826. Simon had been one of my father's two followers, as I had known. My father had been Bloodmaster. With his death, Simon led, being stronger than the other. He brought me to the place he lived the following night, a snug chamber buried in the ruins of an old mountain fortress. There I met the others, a woman whom I recognized as the other servant of my childhood, and two more of my people, whom you call Smith and Brown. Simon had been their master, now I was. More, I brought with me freedom from the red thirst. So we drank and passed many nights, while from their lips I began to learn the history and ways of the people of the night. We are an old people, Abner. Long before your race raised its cities in the hot south, my ancestors swept through the dark winters of northern Europe, hunting. Our tales say we came from the Urals, or perhaps the steppes, spreading west and south through the centuries. We lived in Poland long before the Poles, prowled German forests before the coming of the Germanic barbarians, held sway over Russia before the Tatars, before Novgorod the Great. When I say old, I do not speak of hundreds of years, but of thousands. Millennia passed in the cold and the darkness. We were savage, the stories say. Cunning, naked animals, one with the night, swift and deadly and free, long-lived beyond all other beasts, impossible to kill, the masters and lords of creation. So our stories go. All that walked on two legs or four ran in fear of us. All that lived was but food for us. By day we slept in caves, packs of us, families. By night we ruled the earth. Then, up from the south, your race came into our world. The day people, so like us and yet so unlike. You were weak. We killed you easily and took joy in it, for we found beauty in you, and always my people had been drawn to beauty. Perhaps it was your likeness to us we found so captivating. For centuries you were simply our prey. But changes came with time. My race was very long-lived, but few in number. The mating urge is curiously absent in us, while in you humans it rules as surely as the red thirst rules us. Simon told me, when I asked him of my mother, that the males of my race feel desire only when the female enters heat, and that happens but rarely, most frequently when male and female have shared a kill together. Even then the women are seldom fertile, and for that they are thankful, for conception usually means death for our females. I killed my mother, Simon told me, ripping my way out of her womb, doing such damage inside that even our recuperative powers were of no avail. So it is most often when my people enter this world. We begin our lives in blood and death, even as we live them. There is a certain balance in that. God, if you believe in him, or nature, if not, gives and takes away. We may live for 1,000 years or more. Were we as fertile as you, we would soon fill this world. Your race breeds and breeds and breeds, swarming in numbers like flies. But you die like flies as well, of little wounds and illnesses my kind shrugs off. It is no wonder we thought little of you at first. But you bred, and you built cities, and you learned. You had minds, even as we did. But we had never had cause to use ours, so strong were we. Your kind brought fire into the world, armies, bows and spears and clothing, art and writing and language. Civilization, Abner. And civilized, you were no longer prey. You hunted us down, killed us with flame and stake. Came upon our caves by day. Our numbers, never great, diminished steadily. We fought you and died, or fled you. But where we went, your kind soon followed. Finally, we did as we were forced to do. We learned from you. Clothing and fire, weapons and language, all of it. We never had our own, you see. We borrowed yours. We organized as well, began to think and plan, and finally melted into you entirely, living in the shadows of the world your race built, pretending we were your kind, stealing out by night to slake our thirst on your blood, hiding by day in fear of you and your vengeance. Such has been the story of my race, the people of the night, through most of history. I heard it from Simon's lips, as he had heard it years before from those now slain and gone. Simon was the oldest of the group I had found, claiming almost 600 years. I heard other things as well, legends that went beyond our oral history back to our ultimate origins in the dim dawn of time itself. Even there I saw the hand of your people, where our myths were taken from your Christian Bible. Brown, who had once posed as a preacher, read me passages from Genesis about Adam and Eve and their children Cain and Abel, the first men, the only men. But when Cain slew Abel, he went forth in exile and took a wife from the land of Nod. Where she came from, if the others were the only people in the world, Genesis did not explain. Brown did, however. Nod was the land of night and darkness, he said, and that woman was the mother of our race. From her and Cain are we descended, and thus it is we who are the children of Cain, not the black peoples, as some of your kind believes. Cain slew his brother and hid, and so it is that we must kill our distant cousins and hide ourselves when the sun rises, since the sun is the face of God. We remain long-lived, as all men were in the first days described by your Bible, but our lives are accursed, and must be spent in fear and darkness. So many of my people have believed, I was told. Others held to different myths, some even accepting the vampire tales they had heard, and believing themselves to be undying avatars of evil. I listened to the stories of ancestors long vanished, of struggles and persecutions, of our migrations. Simon told me of a great battle on the desolate shores of the Baltic 1,000 years before, when a few hundred of my race descended by night on a horde of thousands, though the sun came up on a field of blood and corpses. I was reminded of Byron's Sennacherib. Simon spoke of splendid ancient Byzantium, where many of our race had lived and prospered for centuries, invisible in that great teeming city, until the Crusaders came through, plundering and destroying, putting many of us to the torch. They bore the cross, those invaders, and I wondered if perhaps that was the truth behind the legend that my race fears and abhors that Christian symbol. From all lips I heard a legend of a city we had built, a great city of the night, wrought in iron and black marble in some dark caverns in the heart of Asia, by the shores of an underground river and a sea never touched by the sun. Long before Rome or even Ur, our city had been great, they avowed. In flagrant contradiction to the history they had told me earlier of running naked through moonlit winter forests. According to the myth, we had been expelled from our city for some crime, had wandered forgetful and lost for thousands of years. But the city was still there, and someday a king would be born to our people, a bloodmaster greater than any who had ever come before, one who would gather our scattered race together and lead us back to the city of the night beside its sunless sea. Abner, of all that I heard and learned, that tale affected me most greatly. I doubt that any such vast underground city exists, doubt that it ever existed, but the very telling of such a story proved to me that my people were not the evil, empty vampires of legend. We had no art, no literature, not even a language of our own. But the story showed we had the capacity to dream, to imagine. We had never built, never created, only stolen your garments and lived in your cities and fed ourselves on your life, your vitality, your very blood. But we could create, given a chance. We had it within us to whisper stories of cities of our own. The red thirst has been a curse, has made my race and yours enemies, has robbed my people of all noble aspirations. The mark of Cain, indeed. We have had our great leaders, Abner, bloodmasters real and imagined in ages past. We have had our Caesars, our Solomons, our Prester Johns, but we are waiting for our deliverer, you see, waiting for our Christ. Huddled in the ruins of that grim castle, listening to the wind howl outside, Simon and the others drank my liquor and told me stories and studied me from potent, feverish eyes, and I realized what they must think. Each of them was hundreds of years older than I, but I was the stronger. I was bloodmaster. I brought them an elixir that banished the red thirst. I seemed almost half-human. Abner, they saw me as the deliverer of legend, the promised king of the vampires. And I could not deny it. It was my destiny, I knew then, to lead my race from darkness. There are so many things I want to do, Abner, so many things. Your own people are fearful and superstitious and full of hate, so my kind must stay hidden for now. I have seen the way you war on each other. Read of Vlad Tepes, who was not one of us, by the way. Of him and Gaius Caligula and other kings. I have seen your race burn old women because they were suspected of being one of us. And here in New Orleans I have witnessed the way you enslave your own kind, whip them and sell them like animals, simply because of the darkness of their skin. The black people are closer to you, more kin than ever my kind can be. You can even get children on their women, while no such interbreeding is possible between night and day. No, we must remain hidden from your people, for our safety. But free from the red thirst, I hope in time we can reveal ourselves to the enlightened among you, men of science and learning, your leaders. We can help each other so much, Abner. We can teach you your own histories, and from us you may learn how to heal yourselves, how to live longer. For our part, we have only just begun. I have defeated the red thirst, and with help I dream someday of conquering the very sun, so we can go abroad by day. Your surgeons and men of medicine could help our females in childbirth, so procreation need not mean death. There is no limit to what my race can create and accomplish. I realized then, listening to Simon, that I could make us one of the great peoples of the earth. But first I had to find my race, before any of it could begin. The task was not easy. Simon said that in his youth there had been almost 1,000 of us, scattered over Europe from the Urals to Britain. Legend said some of us had migrated south to Africa, or east to Mongolia and Cathay. But no one had any proof of such treks. Of the 1,000 who had dwelled in Europe, most had died in wars or witch trials, or had been hunted down when they grew careless. Perhaps 100 of us were left, Simon guessed. Perhaps fewer. Births had been few, and those who did survive were scattered and hidden. So we began a search that took a decade. I will not bore you with all the details. In a church in Russia we found those books you saw in my cabin, the only literature known to have come from the hand of one of my race. I deciphered them in time, and read the melancholy story of a community of 50 people of the blood, their woes and migrations and battles, their deaths. They were all gone, the last 3 crucified and burned centuries before my birth. In Transylvania we found the burnt-out shell of a mountain fastness, and in caves beneath, the skeletal remains of 2 of my race, rotten wood stakes protruding from their ribs, skulls mounted on poles. I learned a good deal from study of those bones, but we had no living survivors. In Trieste we found a family that never went out by day and were whispered to be strangely pale. Indeed they were. Albinos. In Budapest we came upon a rich woman, a dreadful sick woman, who whipped her maids and bled them with leeches and knives and rubbed the blood into her skin to preserve her beauty. She was one of you, however. I confess I killed her with my own hands, so sick at heart did she make me. She was under no compulsion from the first. Only an evil nature made her do as she did, and that made me furious. Finally, finding nothing, we returned to my home in Scotland. Years passed. The woman in our group, Simon's companion and the servant of my childhood, died in 1840 of causes I was never able to determine. She was less than 500 years old. I dissected her and learned how very different, how very inhuman we are. She had at least 3 organs I have never seen in human cadavers. I have only a vague idea of their function. Her heart was half again the size of a human heart, but her intestines were a mere fraction of the length, and she had a secondary stomach, I think solely for the digestion of blood. And more, but that is of no matter. I read widely, learned other languages, wrote some poetry, dabbled in politics. We attended all the best society gatherings, Simon and I at least. Smith and Brown, as you call them, never did show much interest in English, and kept to themselves. Twice Simon and I went to the continent together on new searches. Once I sent him to India for 3 years alone. Finally, barely 2 years ago, we found Catherine, living in London right under our noses. She was of our race, of course, but more important was the story she told. She said that around 1750, a sizable group of our people had been scattered over France and Bavaria and Austria and even Italy. She mentioned some names. Simon recognized them. We had searched for these people unsuccessfully for years. Catherine told us that one of their number had been tracked and killed by police in Munich in 1753 or so, that the others had grown very frightened. Their bloodmaster decided that Europe had become too populated, too organized for safety. We lived in the cracks and shadows, and those were fewer and fewer, it seemed. So he had chartered a ship, and all of them had departed from Lisbon, bound for the New World, where the savagery and endless forests and rude colonial conditions promised easy prey and safety. Why my father and his group had not been included in the migration, she could not say. She was to go with them, but rains and storms and a broken carriage wheel plagued her trip to Lisbon, and when she arrived, they had departed. Of course, I went at once to Lisbon and pored through whatever old shipping records the Portuguese had preserved. In time, I found it. The ship had never returned from its charter, as I had suspected. At sea, for all that time, they would have had no choice but to feed on the crew one by one. The question was, had the ship ever arrived safely in the New World? I could find no record of it, but I did find the intended destination, the port of New Orleans. From there, via the Mississippi, the whole continent would be open to them. The rest should be obvious. We came. I felt certain I would find them. It seemed to me that by having a steamboat, I would enjoy the luxury I have grown accustomed to, and the mobility and freedom I needed for my search. The river was full of eccentrics. A few more would not be noticed. And if tales of our fabulous boat and the strange captain who only came out by night spread up and down the river, so much the better. The tales might come to the right ears, and they would come to me as Simon did so many years ago. So I made inquiries, and we met one night in St. Louis. You know the rest, I think, or can guess it. Let me say one other thing, however. In New Albany, when you showed our steamer to me, I did not feign my satisfaction. The fever dream is beautiful, Abner, and that was as it should be. For the first time, a thing of beauty has come into the world because of us. It is a new beginning. The name frightened me a bit. Fever has been another word for the red thirst among my people. But Simon pointed out that such a name would likely intrigue any of our race who might hear it. There is my story. Almost all of it. The truth which you insisted on. You have been honest with me in your way, and I believe you when you say you are not superstitious. If my dreams are to come true, there must come a time when day and night clasp hands across the twilight of fear that lies between us. There must come a time for risk. Let it be now, with you. My dream and yours, our steamer, the future of my people and your own, vampires and cattle, I give them all over to your judgment, Abner. What will it be? Trust or fear? Blood or good wine? Friends or enemies? Chapter 15. Aboard the steamer Fever Dream, New Orleans, August 1857. In the heavy silence that followed Joshua's story, Abner Marsh could hear his own steady breathing and the thump of his heart laboring in his chest. Joshua had been talking for hours, it seemed, but in the black stillness of the cabin there was no way to be sure. Outside it might be getting light. Toby would be cooking breakfast. The cabin passengers would be taking their morning strolls along the promenade on the boiler deck. The levee would be bustling with activity. But inside Joshua York's cabin, night went on and on forever. The words of that damned poem came back to him, and Abner Marsh heard himself say, "Morn came and went, and came and brought no day." "Darkness," said Joshua softly. "And you've lived in it your whole damn life," Marsh said. "No morning, not ever." "God, Joshua, how do you stand it?" York made no reply. "It ain't sensible," Marsh said. "It's the goddamnedest story I ever sat still for. But damn it if I don't believe you." "I'd hoped you would," said York. "And now, Abner?" That was the hard part, Abner Marsh thought. "I don't know," he said honestly. "All them people you say you killed, and still I kind of feel sorry for you. Don't know if I ought to. Maybe I ought to try to kill you. Maybe that's the only damn Christian thing to do. Maybe I ought to try to help you." He snorted, annoyed at the dilemma. "I guess what I ought to do is hear you out a little more, and wait before I make up my mind. 'Cause you left something out, Joshua, that you did." "Yes?" York prompted. "New Madrid," said Abner Marsh firmly. "The blood on my hands," Joshua said. "What can I tell you, Abner? I took a life in New Madrid, but it was not as you might suspect."
"Tell me how it was, then. Go on."
"Simon told me many things of the history of our people, our secrets, our customs, our ways. One thing, he said, I found greatly disturbing, Abner. This world that your people have built is a daylight world, not easy for us to live in. Sometimes, to make it easier, one of us will turn to one of you. We can use the power that dwells within our eyes and our voice. We can use our strength, our vitality, the promise of life unending. We can use the very legends your people have erected around us for our own purposes. With lies and fear and promises, we can fashion for ourselves a human thrall. Such a creature can be very useful. He can protect us by day, go where we cannot go, move among men without suspicion. In New Madrid there had been a killing, at the very woodyard where we stopped. From what I read in the newspapers, I had great hopes of finding one of my own race. Instead I found, call him what you will, a slave, a pet, an associate, a thrall. He was an old, old man, a mulatto, bald and wrinkled and hideous, with a milk-glass eye and a face terribly scarred by some ancient fire. He was not pleasing to look at. And inside he was foul, corrupt. When I came upon him, he leaped up, brandishing an axe, and then he looked at my eyes. He recognized me, Abner. He knew what I was at once, and he fell to his knees, crying and blubbering, worshipping me, groveling as a dog to a man, begging me to fulfill the promise. "The promise," he kept saying, "the promise, the promise." Finally, I bid him stop, and he did, at once, cringing away in fear. He had been taught to heed a bloodmaster's words, you see.
I asked him to tell me the story of his life, hoping he might lead me to my own people. His story was grim as my own. He was born a free man of color in a place called the Swamp, which I gather is a notorious district of New Orleans. He lived as a pimp, a cut purse, finally a cut throat, preying on the flatboatman who came down to the city. He'd killed 2 men before he was 10. Later, he served under Vincent Gambi, the bloodiest of the pirates of Barataria. He was overseer to the slaves Gambi stole from Spanish slavers and resold in New Orleans. He was a voodoo man as well, and he had served us. He told me of his bloodmaster, the man who took him in thrall, who laughed at his voodoo and promised to teach him greater, darker magic. "Serve me," the bloodmaster had promised, "and I will make you one of us. Your scars will heal, your eye will see again. You will drink blood and live forever, never aging." So the mulatto had served. For almost 30 years he did everything he was bid. He lived for the promise. He killed for the promise, was taught to eat warm flesh, to drink blood. Until finally his master saw a better opportunity. The mulatto, old and sickly now, became a hindrance. His usefulness passed, so he was discarded. It might have been merciful to kill him, but instead he was sent away upriver to fend for himself. A thrall does not go against his bloodmaster, even if he knows the promise made him to be a lie. So the old mulatto had wandered on foot, living by robbery and murder, moving up the river slowly. Sometimes he earned honest money as a slave catcher or laborer, but mostly he kept to himself in the woods, a recluse who lived by night. When he dared, he ate the flesh and drank the blood of his victims, still believing it would help restore his youth and health. He had been living around New Madrid for a year, he told me. He used to chop some wood for the woodyard man, who was too old and feeble to do it himself. He knew how seldom anyone visited that woodyard. So, well, you know the rest. Abner, your people can learn much from mine, but not the things that he had learned, not that. I felt pity for him. He was old and hideous and without hope. Yet I was angry as well, as angry as I had been in Budapest with the rich woman who liked to wash in blood. In the legends of your race, my people have been made the very essence of evil. The vampire has no soul, no nobility, no hope of redemption, it is said. I will not accept that, Abner. I have killed countless times, have done many terrible things, but I am not evil. I did not choose to be the way I was. Without choice, there can be no good nor evil. My people have never had that choice. The red thirst has ruled us, condemned us, robbed us of all we might have been. But your people, Abner, they have no such compulsion. That thing I encountered in the forest beyond New Madrid, he had never felt the red thirst. He could have been anything, done anything. Instead, he had chosen to become what he was. Oh, to be sure, one of my own race shares the guilt. The man who lied to him, promised him things that could never be. Yet I can understand the reason for that, much as I might loathe it. And a lie among your people can make all the difference. All of us know fear, Abner, my race and yours alike. What I cannot understand is why one of you would lust so after a life in darkness, would desire the red thirst. Yet he did desire it, with a great passion. He begged me not to leave him, as the other bloodmaster had done. I could not give him what he wanted. I would not, even if it had been possible. I gave him what I could. You tore his damn throat out for him, didn't you? Abner Marsh said to the darkness.
I told you,
Valerie said. Marsh had almost forgotten she was there, quiet as she'd been.
He doesn't understand. Listen to him.
I killed him, Joshua admitted, with my bare hands. Yes. His blood ran off my fingers, soaked into the earth. But it did not touch my lips, Abner. And I buried him intact. Another great silence filled the cabin, while Abner Marsh pulled at his beard and thought. "Choice, you said," he volunteered finally. That's the difference between good and evil, you said. Now it looks like I'm the one got to make a choice. We all make our choices, Abner, every day. Maybe that's so, said Marsh. I don't much care for this one, though. You say you want my help, Joshua. Let's say I give it. How's that going to make me any different from that damned old mulatto you killed? Answer me that. I would never make you into something like that, Joshua said. I have never tried. Abner, I will live for centuries after you are dead and gone. Have I ever tried to tempt you with that? You tempted me with a goddamn steamboat instead, Marsh replied. And you sure as hell told me a pack of lies. Even my lies have held a kind of truth, Abner. I told you I sought out vampires to put an end to their evil. Can't you see the truth in that? I need your help, Abner, but as a partner, not as a bloodmaster needs a human thrall. Abner Marsh considered that. All right, he said. Maybe I believe you. Maybe I should trust you. But if you want me for a partner, you're going to have to trust me, too. I've taken you into my confidence, isn't that enough? Hell no, said Abner Marsh. Yeah, you told me the truth, and now you're waiting for an answer. Only if I give the wrong answer, I don't get to leave this cabin alive, do I? Your lady friend there will see to that, even if you don't.
Very perceptive, Captain Marsh, Valerie said from the darkness. I bear you no malice, but Joshua must not be harmed.
Marsh snorted. See what I mean? That ain't trust. We ain't partners on this steamer no more. Things are too goddamned uneven. You can kill me any damn time you want. I gotta behave myself or else I'm dead. The way I see it, that makes me a slave, not no partner. I'm alone, too. You got all your damn blood-drinking friends aboard to help you out if there's trouble. God knows what you're planning, you sure don't tell me. But I can't talk to nobody, you say. Hell, Joshua, maybe you ought to kill me right now. I don't think I like this here kind of partnership.
Joshua York considered that in silence for a time. Then he said, Very well, I see your point. What would you have me do to demonstrate my trust?
For a start, said Marsh, supposing I wanted to kill you, how would I go about it?
No, Valerie cried in alarm. Marsh heard her footsteps as she moved toward Joshua. You can't tell him that. You don't know what he's planning, Joshua. Why would he ask that if he didn't intend to...
To make us even, Joshua said softly.
I understand him, Valerie. And it is a risk we must take. She started to plead again, but Joshua hushed her and said to Marsh,
Fire will do it. Drowning. With a gun, aim for the head. Our brains are vulnerable. A shot through the skull would kill me, while a shot to the heart would only knock me down until I healed. The legends are accurate in one respect. If you cut off our heads and hammer a stake through our hearts, we die.
He gave a raspy chuckle.
One of your kind would do the same, I think. The sun can be deadly as well, as you have seen. The rest, the silver and garlic, that is all nonsense.
Abner Marsh let out his breath noisily, scarcely aware he had been holding it.
Boil me for an egg, he said.
Satisfied? York asked.
Almost, Marsh said. One more thing.
A match scratched against leather, and suddenly a little dancing flame burned in York's cupped palm. He touched it to an oil lamp, so the flame crept across the wick, and a dusky yellow illumination filled the cabin.
There,
Joshua said, extinguishing the match with a wave of his hand. Better, Abner? More even? Partnership demands a little light, don't you think? So we can look each other in the eye? Abner Marsh found he was blinking back tears. After so long in darkness, even a little light seemed terribly bright. But the room looked larger now. The terror and the suffocating closeness of it melted away. Joshua York was regarding Marsh calmly. His face was covered with husks of dry, dead skin. When he smiled, one crackled and flaked away. His lips were still puffy, and he looked as though he had two black eyes, but the burns and blisters were all but gone. The change was astonishing.
"What is this other thing, then, Abner?"
Barsh took York at his word and looked him straight in the eye.
"I ain't going to go this alone," he said. "I'm going to tell."
"No,"
Valerie said from where she stood by Joshua's side. "One is bad enough. We can't let him spread this. They'll kill us."
"Oh, woman, I wasn't figuring on putting no advertisement in the True Delta, you know."
Joshua steepled his fingers and regarded Marsh thoughtfully.
"Just what were you figuring then, Abner?"
"One or two people," Marsh said. "I ain't the only one who's been suspicious, you know. And it could be you'll need more help than I can give you. I'll only talk to them I know I can trust. Harry Mike, for one, and Mr. Jeffers. He's damn smart, and he's already been wondering over you. The rest don't need to know. Mr. Albright is a mite too prim and godly to hear all this, and if you told Mr. Fram, it'd be all over the river inside of a week. The whole damn Texas could burn off without Whitey Blake noticing, so long as his engines weren't bothered none. But Jeffers and Harry Mike, they ought to know. They're good men, and you may need them."
"Need them?" Joshua said. "How is that, Abner?"
"What if one of your folks don't fancy that drink of yours?"
Joshua York's genial smile vanished abruptly. He stood up, walked across the cabin, and poured himself a drink. Whiskey, neat. When he turned back, he was still frowning.
"Perhaps," he said. "I need to think on this. If they can truly be trusted, I have certain misgivings about the trip down the bayou."
For once, Valerie did not utter the expected protest. Marsh glanced at her and saw that her lips were pressed tightly together, and in her eyes was something that might just have been the beginnings of fear.
"What's wrong?" Marsh said. "Both of you look queer."
Valerie's head snapped up.
"Him,"
she said. "I asked you to turn back upriver. I would ask it again if I thought either of you might listen. He is down there at Cypress Landing."
"Who?"
Marsh asked, baffled. "A bloodmaster," Joshua said. "Abner, understand that all my kind do not think as I do. Even among my own followers. Well, Simon is loyal. Smith and Brown are passive. But Catherine, from the very beginning I have felt the resentment in her. I think there is a darkness at the center of it, something that prefers the old ways, that grieves for the ship she missed and chafes under my domination. She obeys because she must. I am bloodmaster. But she does not like it. And the others, those we have taken aboard on the river, I am not sure of them. Except for Valerie and Jean Ardent, I trust none of them fully. Remember your warnings to me about Raymond Ortega? I share your misgivings about him. Valerie means nothing to him, so you were wrong in thinking jealousy a motive, yet otherwise right. To bring Raymond aboard at Natchez, I had to conquer him as I conquered Simon so long ago in the Carpathians. With Cara de Gris and Vincent Thibault, there were other struggles. Now they follow me because they must. It is the way of my people. Yet I wonder if some of them, at least, are not waiting. Waiting to see what will happen when the fever dream steams down the bayou and I come face to face with he who was master of them all. Valerie has told me much of him. He is old, Abner. Older than Simon or Catherine. Older than any of us. His age itself disturbs me. Now he calls himself Damon Julian, but before that name he was Giles Lamont. The same Giles Lamont whom that wretched mulatto served for 30 futile years. I am told he has another human thrall now.
Sour Billy Tipton, Valerie said with loathing.
Valerie is afraid of this Julian, Joshua York said. The others also speak of him with fear, but sometimes with a certain loyalty as well. As bloodmaster, he took care of them. He gave them sanctuary, wealth and feasts. They feasted on slaves. No wonder he chose to settle where he did.
Valerie shook her head. Leave him, Joshua, please, for me, if for no other reason. Damon will not welcome your coming, will not cherish the freedom you bring.
Joshua scowled in annoyance.
He still has others of our people with him. Would you have me abandon them as well?
No.
And you may be wrong about Julian. He has been in the grip of the Red Thirst for uncounted centuries, and I can soothe that fever.
Valerie crossed her arms, her violet eyes furious.
And if he will not be soothed? You do not know him, Joshua.
He is educated, intelligent, cultured, a lover of beauty, York said stubbornly.
You said as much. He is strong as well.
As with Simon and Raymond and Kara. They follow me now.
Damon is different, Valerie insisted. It is not the same.
Joshua York made an impatient gesture.
It makes no difference. I will control him.
Abner Marsh had watched them argue in thoughtful silence, but now he spoke up.
Joshua's right, he said to Valerie. Hell, I looked in his eyes once or twice myself, and he nearly busted every bone in my hand the first time we shook. Besides, what was it you called him? A king?
Yes, Valerie admitted. The Pale King.
Well, if he's this Pale King of yours, it stands to reason that he's got to win, don't it?
Valerie glanced from Marsh to York and back again, then she trembled.
You haven't seen him, either of you.
She hesitated a moment, tossed her dark hair back with a pale, slender hand, and faced Abner Marsh squarely.
Perhaps I was wrong about you, Captain Marsh. I do not have Joshua's strength, nor his trust. I have been ruled by the Red Thirst for half a century. Your people were my prey. You cannot befriend your prey. You cannot. You cannot trust them either. That was why I urged Joshua to kill you. You cannot just cast aside the cautions of a lifetime. Do you understand?
Abner Marsh nodded warily.
I am still uncertain, Valerie continued. But Joshua has been showing us many new things, and I am willing to admit that perhaps you can be trusted.
Perhaps. She scowled fiercely.
But whether or not I was wrong about you, I am right about Damon Julian.
Abner Marsh frowned, not knowing what to say. Joshua reached out and took Valerie's hand in his own.
I think you are wrong to be so fearful, he said. But for your sake, I will move with all caution. Abner, do as you wish. Tell Mr. Jeffers and Mr. Dunn. It will be good to have their help if Valerie is right. Choose the men for a special watch and let the rest ashore. When the fever dream steams up the bayou, I want her manned only by our best and most reliable, the bare minimum needed to run her. No religious fanatics, no one who is easily frightened, no one prone to rashness.
Harry, Mike, and I will do the picking, Marsh said.
I will meet Julian on my own steamer in my own time, with you and the best of your men behind me.
Be careful how you tell Jefferson Dunn. It must be done correctly.
He looked at Valerie.
Satisfied?
No, she said. Joshua smiled.
I can do no more.
He looked back at Abner Marsh.
Abner, I am glad you are not my enemy. I am close now. My dream's at hand. In beating the Red Thirst, I had my first great triumph. I would like to think that here tonight, you and I have fashioned a second, the beginning of friendship and trust between our races. The fever dream will steam on the razor edge between night and day, banishing the specter of old fear wherever she goes. We will achieve great things together, friend.
Marsh didn't care overmuch for flowery talk, but Joshua's passion reached him nonetheless, and he gave a grudging smile.
Got a lot of work to do before we achieve any goddamn thing at all, Marsh said, gathering up his walking stick and getting to his feet.
I'll be going, then.
Fine, Joshua said, smiling. I will take my rest and see you once again at twilight. Make certain the boat is ready to depart. We'll get this done with as quickly as we can.
I'll have our steam up, Marsh said as he took his leave.
Outside, day had come. It looked to be about 9, Abner Marsh thought, as he stood blinking outside the captain's cabin after Joshua had locked the door behind him. The morning was dismal, hot and muggy, with a heavy gray overcast that hid the sun. Soot and smoke from steamers on the river hung in the air. There's going to be a storm, Abner Marsh thought, and the prospect was one he found disheartening. He was suddenly aware of how little sleep he'd gotten, and felt unutterably tired. But there was so much to do that he dared not even consider a nap. He descended to the main saloon, figuring that breakfast would give him some spirit. He drank a gallon of hot black coffee while Toby cooked him up some boiled beef cakes and waffles, with blueberries on the side. As he was eating, Jonathan Jeffers entered the saloon, saw him, and came striding over to the table. "Sit down and eat something," Marsh said. "Want to have a long talk with you, Mr. Jeffers?" "Not here, though. Better wait till I'm through and then go to my cabin." "Fine," Jeffers replied in a distracted sort of way. "Captain, where have you been? I've been looking for you for hours. You weren't in your cabin." "Joshua and I were chatting," Marsh said. "What?" "There's a man here to see you," Jeffers said. "He came aboard in the middle of the night. He's very insistent." "Don't like to be kept around waiting, like I'm some no-count trash," the stranger said. Marsh hadn't even seen the man enter. Without so much as a "by your leave," the man pulled out a chair and sat down. He was an ugly, haggard-looking cuss, his long face cratered by the pox. Thin, limp brown hair hung down in strands across his forehead. His complexion was unhealthy, and patches of hair and skin were covered by scaly white flakes, like he'd been in his own private snowfall. Yet he wore an expensive black broadcloth suit, and a ruffled white shirt front, and a cameo ring. Abner Marsh didn't care for his looks, his tone, the flat press of his lips, his ice-colored eyes. "Who the hell are you?" he said gruffly. "You better have a damn good reason for bothering me at breakfast, or I'll have you chucked over the damn side." Just saying so made Marsh feel somewhat better. He'd always figured there was no use being a steamboat captain if you couldn't tell somebody to go to hell once in a while. The stranger's sour expression changed not a flicker, but he fixed his icy eyes on Marsh with a kind of smirking malice. "I'm going to be taking passage on this fancy raft of yours." "The hell you are," Marsh said. "Shall I call Harry Mike to deal with this ruffian?" Jeffers offered coolly. The man looked at the clerk with brief contempt. His eyes moved back to Marsh. "Captain Marsh, I come last night to bring you an invite for you and your partner. Figured one of you, at least, be out and about by night. Well, it's day now, so it'll have to be tonight instead. Dinner at the St. Louis, along about an hour past sunset. You and Captain York." "I don't know you, and I don't care for you," Marsh said. "I sure ain't going to have dinner with you. Besides, the fever dream is steaming out tonight." "I know. Know where, too." Marsh frowned. "What are you saying?" "You don't know niggers, I can tell. Niggers hear something. Before long, every nigger in the city knows it. And me? I listen good. You don't want to take this big old steamer of yours up the bayou to where you're fixing to go. You'll ground yourself for sure. Maybe rip out your bottom. I can save you all the trouble. You see, the man you're looking for is right here waiting for you. So when dark comes, you go tell that to your master, you hear? You tell him that Damon Julian is waiting for him at the St. Louis Hotel. Mr. Julian is right eager to make his acquaintance." Chapter 16. New Orleans, August 1857. Sour Billy Tipton returned to the St. Louis Hotel that evening more than a little fearful. Julian would not like the message he carried from the fever dream, and Julian was dangerous and unpredictable when displeased. In the darkened parlor of their lavish suite, only a single small candle had been lighted. Its flame was reflected in Julian's black eyes as he sat in the deep velvet chair near the window, sipping a Sazerac. The room was full of silence,
Sour Billy felt the weight of the stairs upon him. The latch made a small, deadly snick when the door shut behind him.
"Yes, Billy?" said Damon Julian softly.
"They won't come, Mr. Julian," Sour Billy said, a little too quickly, a little too breathlessly. In the dim light, he could not see Julian's reaction. "He says you got to come to him."
"He says?" repeated Julian.
"Who is he, Billy?"
"Him," said Sour Billy.
The other Bloodmaster. Joshua York, he calls himself. The one that Raymond wrote you about. The other captain, Marsh, the fat one with the warts and the whiskers, he wouldn't come neither. Damn rude, too. But I waited for dark, waited for the Bloodmaster to get up. Finally they took me to him."
Sour Billy still felt cold, remembering the way that York's gray, gray eyes had touched his own and found him wanting. There had been such bitter contempt there that Billy had wrenched his gaze away at once.
"Tell us, Billy," said Damon Julian, "what is he like, this other, this Joshua York, this Bloodmaster?"
"He's," Billy began, fumbling for words, "he's white. I mean, his skin and all is real pale. And his hair ain't got no color in it. He even wore a white suit, like some kind of hat. And silver. He wore lots of silver. The way he moves, like one of them damn Creoles, Mr. Julian, high and lordly. He's like you, Mr. Julian. His eyes..."
"Pale and strong," murmured Cynthia from the far corner of the room. "And with a wine that conquers the red thirst.
Is he the one, Damon?"
"He must be. It must be true. Valerie always believed the stories, and I mocked her for it. But it must be so.
He will bring us all together, lead us back to the lost city, the dark city, our kingdom, our own. It is true, isn't it? He is Bloodmaster of Bloodmasters, the king we have waited for."
She looked at Damon Julian for an answer. Damon Julian tasted his Sazerac and smiled a sly feline smile.
"The king," he mused. "And what did this king say to you, Billy? Tell us."
"He said to come to the steamer, all of you, tomorrow after dark. For dinner, he said. Him and Marsh, they won't come here, not like you want it, alone. Marsh, he said that if they come to you, it's going to be with others."
"The king is strangely timid," Julian commented.
"Kill him," Sour Billy blurted suddenly. "Go to that damn boat and kill him. Kill them all." "He's wrong, Mr. Julian. His eyes, like some damn Creole, the way he looked at me. Like I was a bug, a no-count. Even though I come from you, he thinks he's better than you, and them others. That warty captain and this damn clerk all dandied up. Let me cut him, bleed him some all over them fine clothes of his. You gotta go kill him. You got to."
The room was silent after Sour Billy's outburst. Julian stared out the window off into the night. The windows had been thrown wide, so the curtains stirred lazily in the night air, and street noises drifted up from below. Julian's eyes were dark, hooded, fixed on distant lights. When at last he turned his head, his pupils caught the gleam of the single candle flame again and held it within, red and flickering. His face took on a lean, feral cast.
"The drink, Billy?" he prompted. "He makes them all drink it," Sour Billy said.
He leaned back against the door and pulled out his knife. It made him feel better to have it in hand. He began scraping crud out from under his nails as he spoke.
"It ain't just blood," Era said. "Something else in it. It kills the thirst, they all say that. I went all over that boat. Talked to Raymond and Jean and George. Couple others. They told me. Jean kept raving about this drink, about what a relief it was, if you can believe that."
"Jean,"
said Julian with disdain. "It is true, then," Cynthia said. "He is greater than the thirst."
"There's more," Sour Billy added. "Raymond says York has taken up with Valerie."
The stillness in the parlor was full of tension. Kurt frowned. Michelle averted her eyes. Cynthia sipped at her drink. All of them knew that Valerie, beautiful Valerie, had been Julian's special pet. All of them watched him carefully. Julian seemed pensive.
"Valerie?" he said.
"I see." Long, pale fingers tapped on the arm of his chair. Sour Billy Tipton picked at his teeth with the point of his knife, pleased. He figured that bit about Valerie would settle it. Damon Julian had had plans for Valerie, and Julian did not like his plans disturbed. He'd told Billy all about it, with an air of sly amusement, when Billy had asked him why he'd gone and sent her away. "Raymond is young and strong, and he can hold her," Julian had said. "They will be alone, the two of them, alone with each other and the thirst. Such a romantic vision, don't you think? And in a year or two, or five, Valerie will be with child. I would almost bet on it, Billy." And then he had laughed, that deep musical laugh of his. But he was not laughing now. "What will we do, Damon?" Bert asked. "Are we going?"
"Why, of course," Julian said. "We could hardly refuse such a kind invitation, and from a king at that. Don't you want to taste this wine of his?"
He looked at each of them in turn, and none of them dared speak.
"Ah," said Julian, "where is your enthusiasm? Jean recommends this vintage to us, and Valerie as well, no doubt, a wine sweeter than blood, thick with the stuff of life. Think of the peace it will bring us."
He smiled. No one spoke. He waited. When the quiet had gone on a long while, Julian shrugged and said, "Well, then, I hope the king will not think less of us if we prefer other drinks."
"He makes the rest of them drink it," Sour Billy said, "whether they want to or not."
"Damon," Cynthia said, "will you refuse him? You can't. We must go to him. We must do as he bids us. We must."
Julian turned his head slowly to look at her.
"Do you really think so?" he asked, smiling thinly.
"Yes," Cynthia whispered. "We must. He is blood master."
She averted her eyes. "Cynthia," said Damon Julian, "look at me." Slowly, with infinite reluctance, she raised her head again until her gaze met Julian's.
"No," she whimpered. "Please. Oh, please."
Damon Julian said nothing. Cynthia did not look away. She slipped from her chair, knelt on the carpet, trembling. A bracelet of spun gold and amethysts shone on her small wrist. She pushed it aside, and her lips parted slowly as if she were about to speak. And then she raised her hand and touched mouth to wrist. The blood began to flow. Julian waited until she had crawled across the carpet, her arm extended an offering. With grave courtesy, he took her hand in his and drank long and deeply. When he was done, Cynthia got to her feet unsteadily, slipped back to one knee, and rose again, shaking.
"Blood master," she said, head bowed. "Blood master."
Damon Julian's lips were red and wet, and a tiny bead of blood had trickled down one corner of his mouth. Julian took a handkerchief from his pocket, carefully blotted the thin line of moisture from his chin, and tucked it neatly away.
"Is it a large steamer, Billy?" he asked.
Sour Billy sheathed his knife behind him with a practiced, easy motion, smiling. The wound on Cynthia's wrist, the blood on Julian's chin, it all left him hot, excited. Julian would show those damn steamboat people, he thought.
"Big as any steamboat I ever seen," he answered. "And fancy, too. Silver and mirrors and marble. Lots of stained glass and carpet. You'll like her, Mr. Julian."
A steamboat, mused Damon Julian. Why did I never think of the river, I wonder? The advantages are so obvious.
Then we are going? Said Kurt.
Yes, said Julian. Oh, yes.
Why, the Bloodmaster has summoned us.
The king.
He laughed, throwing back his head, roaring. The king! He cried between gusts of laughter.
The king!
One by one, the others began to laugh with him. Julian rose abruptly, like a jackknife unfolding, his face gone solemn again, and the uproar quieted as suddenly as it had begun. He stared out into the darkness beyond the hotel.
We must bring a gift, he said. One does not call upon royalty without a gift.
He turned to Sour Billy. Tomorrow you will go down to Moreau Street, Billy. There is something I wish you to get for me. A little gift for our pale king.
Chapter 17. Aboard the steamer Fever Dream, New Orleans, August 1857.
It seemed as though half the steamers in New Orleans had decided to leave that afternoon, Abner Marsh thought as he stood upon the hurricane deck and watched them all depart. The custom was for boats going upriver to make their departure from the levee about 5 o'clock. At 3, the engineers would fire the furnaces and start to get the steam up. Rosin and pitchpine would get chucked into the steamer's hungry maws, along with wood and coal, and from one boat after another the black smoke would start to rise, ascending from the lofty flowered chimneys in tall hot columns, dark pennants of farewell. 4 miles of steamboats packed solid along the levee can generate a lot of smoke. The sooty columns would start to blend together into one massive black cloud a couple hundred feet above the river. A cloud shot through with ash, full of hot bright cinders, adrift on the wind. Larger and larger the cloud would swell as still more steamers fired up and poured out smoke until the pall blotted out the sun and began to creep across the face of the city. From Abner Marsh's vantage point on the hurricane deck, it looked as though the whole city of New Orleans was going up in flames, and all the steamers were about to flee. It made him feel uneasy, as if somehow the other captains knew something he did not, as if the Fever Dream, too, ought to be getting up her steam and making ready to back out. Marsh was anxious to be off. For all the wealth and glamour of the New Orleans trade, he yearned for the rivers he knew, for the upper Mississippi with its bluffs and dense woods, for the wild, muddy Missouri that ate steamers like nobody's business, for the narrow Illinois and the silty, bustling Fever. The Fever Dream's maiden voyage down the Ohio seemed almost idyllic to him now, a remembrance of simpler, better days. Not even 2 months gone, it seemed an eternity ago. Ever since they'd left St. Louis and come down river, things had been going wrong, and the further south they'd come, the worse they'd gotten. Joshua is right, Marsh muttered to himself as he looked out over New Orleans. There's something rotten here. It was too damned hot, too damned wet, with too damn many bugs, enough to make a man think there was a curse on the whole damn place. And maybe there was, on account of the slavery, though Marsh wasn't sure about that. All he was sure of was that he wanted to tell Whitey to fire up the boilers and roust Fram or Albright up to the pilot house, so he could back the Fever Dream clear of the landing and get her upriver. Now, before sunset. Before they arrived. Abner Marsh wanted to shout those orders so bad he could taste the words, lying bitter and unspoken on his tongue. He felt a kind of superstitious dread about this evening, though he told himself over and over that he was not a superstitious man. Still, he wasn't blind, either. The sky was hot and suffocating, and west of them a storm was building, a big one, a ripper, the storm that Dan Albright had smelled a couple days back. And the steamers were leaving, one after another, dozens of them. And as Marsh watched them recede upriver and vanish in the shimmering waves of heat, he felt more and more alone, as if each steamboat that faded into the distance carried a small bit of him aboard her, a piece of courage, a hunk of his certainty. A dream or a small, sooty hope. Lots of steamers left New Orleans every day, Marsh thought to himself, and today is no different. It's just a day like any other day on the river in August, hot and smoky and lazy. Everyone moving slow, waiting, maybe for a breath of cool air, or for the clean, fresh rain that would wash the smoke from the sky. But another part of him, an older and deeper part, knew that what they waited for was neither cool nor clean, and it would bring no relief from the heat, the dampness, the bugs, the fear. Down below, Hairy Mike was roaring at his roustabouts and making threatening gestures with his black iron billet, but the noises from the landing and the bells and whistles of the other steamers drowned out his words. A mountain of cargo waited on the levee, almost 1,000 tons, the Fever Dream's top capacity. Hardly a quarter of it had been carried across the narrow planks to the main deck. It would take hours to get the rest aboard. Even if he wanted to, Marsh could not take them out, not with all that freight awaiting on the landing. Harry, Mike, and Jeffers and the rest would think he'd gone mad. He wished he'd been able to tell them, like he'd intended to make plans with them. But there wasn't time. Everything had begun to move so quickly, and tonight after dark this Damon Julian would come aboard the Fever Dream to dine. There was no time to talk to Harry Mike or Jonathan Jeffers, no time to explain or persuade or deal with the doubts and questions they'd surely have. So tonight Abner Marsh would be alone, or almost alone, just him and Joshua and a room full of them, the night folks. Marsh did not count Joshua York with the others. He was different somehow. And Joshua said that everything would go well. Joshua had his drink. Joshua was full of fine-sounding words and dreams. But Abner Marsh had his misgivings. The Fever Dream was quiet, almost deserted. Joshua had sent almost everyone ashore. The dinner tonight would be as private as he could make it. That wasn't the way Abner Marsh would have liked it. But there was no arguing with Joshua when he got a notion in his head. In the main cabin, the table was already set. The lamps had not been lighted yet, and the smoke and steam and building storm outside had all conspired to make the illumination that poured through the skylights dim and somber and tired. It seemed to Marsh as if twilight had already come to the saloon and to his steamer. The carpets looked almost black. The mirrors were full of shadows. Behind the long black marble bar, a man was cleaning glasses, but even he was indistinct somehow, faded. Marsh nodded to him nonetheless and made his way to the kitchen after the wheelhouse. Behind the kitchen doors he found activity. A couple of Toby's kitchen boys were stirring big copper pots or pan-frying chicken, while the waiters lounged around and joked with each other. Marsh could smell pies baking in the huge ovens. It made his mouth water, but he pushed past, resolute. He found Toby in the starboard galley, surrounded on all sides by stacks of cages full of chickens and pigeons, and here and there some robins and ducks and such. The birds were making a terrible racket. Toby looked up when Marsh entered. The cook had been killing chickens. 3 headless birds were piled up by his elbows, and a 4th was on the block in front of him, struggling fitfully. Toby had the cleaver in hand. "Why, Captain Marsh," he said, smiling. He brought the cleaver down smartly with a solid thunk. Blood spurted, and the headless chicken thrashed crazily when Toby released it. His hard black hands were drenched with blood. He wiped them on his apron. "What can I do for you?" he asked. "I just wanted to tell you, tonight, when dinner's done, I want you off the boat," Marsh said. "You serve us up good and proper, and then you get. And take your kitchen boys and them waiters with you. You understand, do you? You hear what I'm saying?"
"I surely do, Captain," Toby said with a grin. "I surely do. Going to have a little party, is you?"
"Never you mind about that," Marsh said. "Just see that you get ashore when you're done working."
He turned to go, stern-faced. But something made him turn back.
"Toby," he said.
"Yes, sir?"
"You know I never held much with slavery, even if I never done much against it, neither. I would have, but those damned abolitionists were such Bible thumpers. Only I've been thinking, and it seems to me maybe they was right after all.
You can't just go using another kind of people, like there wasn't people at all. Know what I mean? Got to end sooner or later. Better if it ends peaceful, but it's got to end even if it has to be with fire and blood, you see? Maybe that's what them abolitionists been saying all along. You try to be reasonable, that's only right. But if it don't work, you got to be ready. Some things is just wrong. They got to be ended. Toby was looking at him queerly, still absent-mindedly wiping his hands across the front of his apron, back and forth, back and forth. "Captain," he said softly, "you is talking abolition. This here is slave country, Captain. You could get killed for such talk." "Maybe I could, Toby, but right is right, that's what I say. You done good by old Toby, Captain Marsh, giving me my freedom and all so's I could cook for you. That you did." Abner Marsh nodded. "Toby," he said, "why don't you go fetch me a knife from the kitchen? Don't say nothing about it, you hear? Just go fetch me a good sharp knife. It ought to be able to slide down into my boot, I think. Can you get me a knife?"
"Yes, sir, Captain Marsh," said Toby.
His eyes narrowed just a little in his worn black face.
"Yes, sir."
Then he ran to obey. Abner Marsh walked a little strangely for the next couple hours, with the long kitchen knife snugly tucked into his high leather boot. By the time dark had fallen, however, the blade had begun to feel damned comfortable, and he almost forgot that it was there. The storm came just before sunset. Most of the steamers headed upriver were long gone by then, although others had come to take their places along the New Orleans levee. The storm broke, with a terrible roaring sound like a steamer's boilers going up, and a lightning flashed overhead, and the rain came a screaming down, torrential as a spring flood. Marsh stood beneath the cover of the boiler deck promenade, listening to the water pound against the steamer, and watching folks on the landing scramble for cover. He had been standing there for the longest time, leaning on the rail and thinking, when suddenly Joshua York was there beside him. "It's raining, Joshua," Marsh said, pointing his stick out into the storm. "Maybe this Julian won't be coming tonight. Maybe you don't want to get wet." Joshua York wore a strange, solemn look. "He will come," he said. That was all, just, "He will come." And, finally, he did. The storm had subsided by then. The rain still came down and down, but it was gentler, softer, hardly more than a mist. Abner Marsh was still on the boiler deck, and he saw them coming, striding across the deserted, rain-slick levee. Even at a distance, he knew it was them. There was something about the way they walked, something graceful and predatory, full of a terrible beauty. One of them walked different, swaggering and sliding like he was trying to be one of them, but couldn't, and when they came closer, Marsh saw that it was Sour Billy Tipton. He was carrying something awkwardly. Abner Marsh went on into the Grand Saloon. The others were all at table. Simon and Catherine, Smith and Brown, Raymond and Jean and Valerie, and all the others that Joshua had gathered along the river. They were talking softly, but they fell silent when Marsh entered. "They're coming," Marsh said. Joshua York rose from his seat at the head of the table and went to meet them. Abner Marsh went to the bar and poured himself a whiskey. He drained it in a gulp, had another quickly, then went to the table. Joshua had insisted Marsh sit right up by the head on his left-hand side. The chair to his right was saved for this Damon Julian. Marsh plopped down heavily and scowled at the empty place across from him. And then they entered. Only the four night folks came into the saloon, Marsh noted. Sour Billy had been left behind somewhere, which suited him just fine. There were two women and a huge white-faced man who frowned darkly and shook the moisture from his coat, and the other, him. Marsh knew him instantly. He had a smooth, ageless face, framed by black curls, and he looked like some kind of lord in his dark burgundy suit, with a loose-collared silk shirt all ruffled down the front. On one finger he wore a gold ring with a sapphire the size of a sugar cube,
and fastened to his black vest was a headlight, a polished chunk of black diamond, and a soft web of yellow gold. He moved across the room, and then, rounding the table, he paused and stood by Joshua's place, behind the chair at the head of the table. He put his smooth white hands up on the chair back, and he looked at them, one by one, all along the table. And they rose, the three who had come with him first, and then Raymond Ortega, and then Kara, and then the rest in ones and twos, Valerie last of all. Everyone in the room was standing, everyone but Abner Marsh. Damon Julian smiled a charming, warm smile. "It is good to be together with all of you once again," he said. He looked especially at Catherine. "My dear, how many years has it been? How very many years?" The grin that lit her vulture face was terrible to behold, Marsh thought. He decided to take matters into his own hands. "Sit down," he barked up at Damon Julian. He tugged him by the sleeve. "I'm hungry, and we've waited supper just about long enough." "Yes," said Joshua. And that broke the spell, and everyone took seats again. But Julian took Joshua's seat, the seat at the head of the table. Joshua came and stood over Julian. "You are in my seat," he said. His voice seemed flat and tense. "This one is yours, sir, if you will be so kind." York gestured. His eyes were fixed on Damon Julian, and Marsh glanced up at Joshua's face and saw the power there, the cold intensity, the determination. Damon Julian smiled. "Ah," he said softly. He shrugged slightly. "Pardon." Then, never looking up at Joshua York for even an instant, he rose and moved to the other seat. Joshua seated himself stiffly and made an impatient motion with his fingers. A waiter came hurrying from the shadows and deposited a bottle on the table in front of York. "Kindly leave the room," Joshua told the youth. The bottle was unlabeled. Beneath the chandeliers, surrounded by gleaming crystal and silver, it seemed dark and threatening. It had been opened. "You know what this is," Joshua York said flatly to Damon Julian. "Yes." York reached out, took up Julian's wine glass, and poured. He filled the glass to the brim, and put it down again, squarely in front of the other. "Drink," he ordered. York's eyes were on Julian. Julian stared at the glass, a faint smile playing around the corners of his mouth, as if he were involved in some secret amusement. The grand saloon was utterly silent. Far off in the distance, Marsh heard the faint wail of a steamer struggling through the rain. The moment seemed to last forever. Damon Julian reached out, took up the glass, and drank. In a single long draught, he emptied the glass, and it was as if he drank all the tension from the room. Joshua smiled. Abner Marsh grunted. And down at the far end of the table, others traded wary, puzzled glances. York poured three more glasses and had them passed down to Julian's three companions. All of them drank. Conversations began in low whispers. Damon Julian smiled at Abner Marsh. "Your steamer is most impressive, Captain Marsh," he said cordially. "I hope the food is as excellent." "The food," said Marsh, "is better." He bellowed, feeling almost like his own self again, and the waiters began bringing out the feast that Toby had cooked up. For more than an hour they ate. The night folks had fine manners, but their appetites were healthy as any riverman's. They went at the food like a bunch of roustabouts who just heard the mate shout, "Grub pile!" All except Damon Julian, that was. Julian ate slowly, almost delicately, pausing often to sip at his wine, smiling frequently for no apparent reason. Marsh had cleaned off his third platter, and Julian's plate was still half full. Conversation was relaxed and inconsequential. Those far away talked low and heatedly, so Marsh couldn't make out what they were saying. Up close, Joshua York and Damon Julian mouthed a lot of words about the storm, the heat, the river, and the fever dream. Except for when they were talking about his steamer, Abner Marsh took little interest, preferring to concentrate on his plate. Finally, coffee and brandy were served, and then the waiters faded away, and the main cabin of the steamer was empty but for Abner Marsh and the night folks. Marsh sipped at his brandy and heard the noise he made, sucking it up before he quite realized that all conversations had ceased. "We are together at last," Joshua said in a quiet voice. "And this is a new beginning for us, for the people of the night. Those who live by day might call it a new dawning." He smiled. "For us, a new sunset might be a more appropriate metaphor. Listen, all of you. Let me tell you what my plans." Then Joshua rose and began to speak in earnest. How long he spoke, Abner Marsh was not sure. Marsh had heard it all before. Freedom from the red thirst, an end of fear, trust between day and night, the things that would be achieved by partnership, the grand new epoch. On and on Joshua went, eloquent, impassioned, his speech full of little snatches of poems and $5 words. Marsh paid more attention to the others, to the rows of pale faces all up and down the table. All of them had their eyes on Joshua. All of them were listening, silent. But they weren't all the same. Simon seemed a little jumpy and kept glancing from York to Julian and back again. Jean Ardent looked rapt and worshipful, but some of the other faces were blank and cold and hard to read. Raymond Ortega was smiling slyly, and the big one called Kurt was frowning, and Valerie looked nervous. And Catherine, she had on her thin, hard face such a look of utter loathing that Marsh flinched to see it. Then Marsh looked directly across the table to where Damon Julian was seated, and found Julian staring back at him. His eyes were black, hard and shiny as a lump of the best coal. Marsh saw pits there, endless, bottomless pits, a chasm waiting to swallow them all up. He wrenched his eyes away, unwilling to even try to stare down Julian, as he had foolishly tried to stare down York so long ago at the planter's house. Julian smiled, glanced up again at Joshua, sipped at his cold coffee, and listened. Abner Marsh did not like that smile, nor the depth of those eyes. All at once he was afraid again. And finally Joshua finished and sat down. "The steamboat is a fine idea," Julian said pleasantly. His soft voice carried the length of the saloon. "Your drink may even have its uses from time to time. The rest, dear Joshua, you must forget." His tone was charming, his smile relaxed and brilliant. Someone drew in his breath sharply, but no one dared to speak. Abner Marsh sat up very straight. Joshua frowned. "Excuse me," he said. Julian made a languid gesture of dismissal. "Your story makes me sad, dear Joshua," he said. "Raised among the cattle, now you think as they do. It is not your fault, of course. In time you will learn. You will celebrate your true nature. They have corrupted you, these little animals you have lived among. They have filled you with their small moralities, their feeble religions, their tedious dreams." "What are you saying?" Joshua's voice was angry. Julian did not answer him directly. Instead, he turned to Marsh. "Captain Marsh," he asked, "that roast you so enjoyed was once part of a living animal. Do you suppose that, if that beast could talk, he would consent to being eaten?" His eyes, those fierce black eyes, were locked on Marsh, demanding an answer. "Hell no, but you eat him anyway, do you not?" Julian laughed lightly. "Of course you do, Captain. Don't be ashamed of it." "I ain't ashamed," Marsh said stoutly. "It's only a cow." "Of course it is," said Julian. "And cattle are cattle." He looked back at Joshua York. "But the cattle may see it differently. However, that ought not trouble the captain here. He is a higher order of being than his cow. It is his nature to kill and eat,
and the cows to be killed and eaten. You see, Joshua, life is really very simple. Your errors rise from being raised among cows, who have taught you not to consume them. Evil, you talk about. Where did you learn that concept? From them, of course, from the cattle. Good and evil, those are cattle words, empty, intended only to preserve their worthless lives. They live and die in mortal dread of us, their natural superiors. We haunt even their dreams. So they seek solace in lies, and invent gods who have power over us, wanting to believe that somehow crosses and holy water can master us. You must understand, dear Joshua, that there is no good or evil, only strength and weakness, masters and slaves. You are feverish with their morality, with guilt and shame. How foolish that is! These are their words, not ours. You preach of new beginnings, but what shall we begin? To be as cattle? To burn beneath their sun? Work when we might take? Bow to cattle gods? No. They are animals, our natural inferiors, our great and beautiful prey. That is the way of things. No, said Joshua York. He pushed back his chair and rose, so he stood over the table like a pale, slender Goliath. They think, they dream, and they have built a world, Julian. You are wrong. We are cousins, both sides of the same coin. They are not prey. Look at all they have done. They bring beauty into the world. What have we created? Nothing. The red thirst has been our bane. Damon Julian sighed. Ah, poor Joshua, he said. He sipped his brandy. Let the cattle create. Life, beauty, what you will. And we shall take their creations, use them, destroy them if we choose. That is the way of it. We are the masters. Masters do not labor. Let them make the suits, we shall wear them. Let them build the steamboats, we shall ride upon them. Let them dream of life eternal. We shall live it, and drink of their lives, and savor the blood. We are the lords of this earth, and that is our heritage. Our destiny, if you will, dear Joshua. Exult in your nature, Joshua. Do not seek to change it. Those cattle who truly know us envy us. Any of them would be as we are, given the choice. Julian smiled maliciously. Have you ever wondered why this Jesus Christ of theirs bid his followers to drink his blood, if they would live forever? He chuckled. They burn to be like us, just as the darkies dream of being white. You see how far they go? To play at being masters, they even enslave their own kind. As you do, Julian, said Joshua York dangerously. What else do you call the dominion you have held over our people? Even those you call masters you make slaves to your own twisted will. Even we have strong and weak among us, dear Joshua, said Damon Julian. It is fitting that the strong should lead. Julian set down his glass and looked far down the table. Kurt, he said, summon Billy. Yes, Damon, said the big man, rising. Where are you going? Joshua demanded as Kurt strode from the room, his image moving purposefully across a dozen mirrors. You have played at being cattle long enough, Joshua, said Julian. I am going to teach you what it means to be a master. Abner Marsh felt cold and frightened. All the eyes in the room were glassy, transfixed, watching the drama at the head of the table. Standing, Joshua York seemed to tower over the seated Damon Julian, but somehow he did not dominate. Joshua's gray eyes looked as strong and passionate as a man's could be. But Julian wasn't a man at all, Marsh thought. Kurt was back in less than a moment. Sour Billy must have been just outside somewhere, like a slave waiting for his master's summons. Kurt took his place again. Sour Billy Tipton sauntered right up to the head of the table, carrying something, with a strange sort of excitement in his icy eyes.
Damon Julian swept the plates aside with an arm, clearing a space on the table. Sour Billy shifted his burden and set a small brown infant down on the tablecloth in front of Joshua York.
"What the hell?"
Marsh roared. He pushed back from the table, glaring, and started to rise.
"Sit down and keep real quiet, boy,"
Sour Billy said in a flat, quiet voice. Marsh started to turn toward him and felt something cold and very sharp press gently against the side of his neck.
"You open your mouth and I'm going to have to bleed you,"
Sour Billy said.
"Can you just imagine what they'll do when they see all that nice, hot blood?"
Trembling, caught between rage and terror, Abner Marsh sat very still. The point of Billy's knife pressed a little harder, and Marsh felt something warm and wet trickle down into his collar.
"Good," whispered Billy. "Real nice."
Joshua York glanced briefly at Marsh and Sour Billy, then turned his attention back to Julian.
"I find this obscene," he said coldly. "Julian, I do not know why you had this child brought here, but I do not like it. This game will end right now. Tell your man to take his knife away from the captain's throat."
"Ah," said Julian. "And if I do not choose to?"
"You will choose to," said Joshua. "I am Bloodmaster."
"Are you?"
asked Julian lightly.
"Yes.
I do not like to use your methods of compulsion, Julian, but if I must, I shall."
"Ah," said Julian.
He smiled. He stood up, stretched lazily like some great dark cat waking from a nap, then extended a hand across the table toward Sour Billy.
"Billy, give your knife to me," he said.
"But what about him?"
Sour Billy said. "Captain Marsh will behave himself now," said Julian.
"The knife."
Billy handed it over, hilt first.
"Good,"
said Joshua. He got no further. The baby, undersized, scrawny, very brown and very naked, made a sort of gurgling noise just then and stirred feebly. And Damon Julian did the most horrible thing that Abner Marsh had ever seen in all his born days. Swiftly and very delicately, he leaned over the table and brought down Sour Billy's knife and cut the infant's small right hand clean off with a single smooth stroke. The baby began to howl. Blood spurted onto the table, over the crystal glasses and the silverware and the fine white linen. The baby's limbs thrashed feebly, and the blood began to pool. And Julian impaled the severed hand. It was so impossibly tiny, hardly the size of Marsh's big toe, on the blade of Billy's knife. He held it up, dripping, in front of Joshua York.
"Drink,"
he said, and all the lightness was gone from his voice. York slapped the knife aside. It spun from Julian's hand, the hand still impaled upon it, and landed 6 feet away on the carpet. Joshua looked like death. He reached down, put two strong fingers on either side of the infant's thrashing wrist, and pressed. The bleeding stopped.
"Get me a cord," he commanded.
No one moved. The infant was still screaming.
"There is an easier way to quiet him," Julian said.
He took his own hard, pale hand and clamped it down across the child's mouth. The hand enveloped the small brown head completely and stifled all sound. Julian began to squeeze.
"Release him," shouted York.
"Look at me," said Julian. "Look at me, Bloodmaster."
And their eyes met as they stood there above the table, each with a hand on the small brown piece of humanity before them. Abner Marsh just sat there, thunderstruck, sick and furious, and wanting to do something, but somehow unable to move. Like all the rest of them, he stared at York and Julian, at the strange, silent battle of wills. Joshua York was trembling. His mouth was tight with anger, and cords stood up in his neck, and his gray eyes were as cold and forceful as an ice jam. He stood there like a man possessed, a pale, wrathful god in white and blue and silver. It was impossible for anything to withstand that outpouring of will, of strength, Marsh thought. Impossible. And then he looked at Damon Julian. The eyes dominated the face, cold, black, malevolent, implacable, Abner Marsh looked into those eyes a moment too long, and suddenly he felt dizzy. He heard men screaming somewhere, distantly, and his mouth was warm with the taste of blood. He saw all the masks that were called Damon Julian, and Giles Lamont, and Gilbert Dacquin, and Philip Kane, and Sergei Alexov, and a thousand other men fall away. And behind each one was another, older and more horrible, layer on layer of them, each more bestial than the last. And at the bottom the thing had no charm, no smile, no fine words, no rich clothing or jewels. The thing had nothing of humanity, was nothing of humanity, had only the thirst, the fever. Red. Red. Ancient and insatiable. It was primal and inhuman, and it was strong. It lived and breathed and drank the stuff of fear. And it was old, oh, so old, older than man and all his works, older than the forests and rivers, older than dreams. Abner Marsh blinked, and there across the table from him was an animal, a tall, handsome animal in burgundy. And there was nothing the least bit human about it. And the lines of its face were the lines of terror. And its eyes. Its eyes were red, not black at all, red, and lit from within, and red, burning, thirsting, red. Joshua York released the infant's stump. A sudden, pent-up wash of blood spurted feebly out across the table. An instant later, a sound like a terrible wet crunch filled the saloon. And Abner Marsh, still half-dazed, slid the long kitchen knife out of his boot and came out of his seat screaming, raving, slashing. Sawyer Billy tried to grab him from behind, but Marsh was too strong, too wild. He brushed Billy aside and flung himself across the dinner table at Damon Julian. Julian broke away from Joshua York's eyes just in time and pulled back slightly. The knife missed his eye by a fraction of an inch and left a long, open gash down the right side of his face. Blood welled out of the wound, and Julian made a snarling sound deep in his throat. Then someone seized Marsh from behind and dragged him off the table and flung him backward across the grand saloon, lifted him and flung him, all 300 pounds of him, like he was a small child. It hurt something fierce when he landed, but somehow Marsh managed to roll over and get back to his feet. It was Joshua had thrown him, he saw. And Joshua, who was standing closest to him now, Joshua, with pale hands trembling and gray eyes full of fear. "Run, Abner," he said. "Get off the steamer. Run!" Behind him, the others had all risen from the table, white faces, eyes intent and staring, hands pale and hard and grasping. Catherine was smiling, smiling at him the way she'd smiled when she'd caught him coming from Joshua's cabin. Old Simon was shaking. Even Smith and Brown were drifting toward him, slowly, ringing him in, and their eyes were not friendly, and their lips were wet. They were all moving, all of them, and Damon Julian came gliding around the table, almost soundless, the blood drying on his cheek, the gash closing almost as Marsh watched. Abner Marsh looked down at his hands and discovered that he had lost the knife. He backed up, step by step, until his back was up against a mirrored stateroom door.
"Run, Abner,"
Joshua York repeated. Marsh fumbled and opened the door and backed into the cabin behind him, and he saw Joshua turn his back and stand between the cabin and the others, Julian and Catherine and all the rest, the night folks, the vampires. And that was the last thing he saw before he broke and ran. Chapter 18. Aboard the steamer Fever Dream, Mississippi River, August 1857. When the sun rose over New Orleans the next morning, a swollen yellow eye that turned the river mists to crimson and promised a scorching day, Abner Marsh was waiting on the levee. He had run a long way the night before, plunging through the gaslit streets of the Vieux Carré like a madman, smashing into strollers, stumbling and panting, running as he had never run in all his years, until finally he realized, belatedly, that no one was pursuing him. Then Marsh had found a dim, smoky grog shop and put down 3 quick whiskies to stop his shaking hands. And finally, close to dawn,
He had started back toward the fever dream. Never in his life had Abner Marsh been angrier or more ashamed. They had run him off his own damn steamboat, stuck a knife to his neck, slaughtered a goddamn baby right in front of him, on his own table. No one got away with treating Abner Marsh like that, he thought. Not white men, nor coloreds, nor red Indians, nor any goddamn vampires. Damon Julian was going to be mighty regretful, he swore to himself. Day had come now, and the hunters would become the prey. The landing was already humming with activity when Marsh approached. Another big side-wheeler had put in beside the fever dream and was unloading. Peddlers were selling fruits and frozen creams from wheeled carts. One or two hotel omnibuses had put in an appearance, and the fever dream had her steam up, Marsh saw with surprise and alarm. Dark smoke was curling upward from her chimneys, and down below a ragtag group of roustabouts was loading up the last of the freight. He quickened his pace and accosted one of them. He shouted, "You there, hold on!" The rouster was a huge, thickly built black man with a shiny bald head and one missing ear. He turned at Marsh's shout, a barrel on his right shoulder. "Yes, sir, Captain." "What's going on here?" Marsh demanded. "Why is the steam up? I didn't give no orders." The rouster frowned. "I just loads them up, Captain. Don't know nothing, sir." Marsh swore and moved past him. Harry Mike Dunn came swaggering across the stage, his iron billet in hand. "Mike," called Marsh. Harry Mike frowned, a fierce look of concentration on his dark face. "Morning, Captain. You really sell this here boat?"
"What?"
"Captain York, he says you sold your half to him. Says you ain't a-coming with us. I got back a couple hours past midnight, me and some of them boys, and York, he says you and him figured two captain were one too many, and he bought you out. And he told Whitey to get the steam up, he did, and here we is. That the truth of it, Captain?" Marsh scowled. The roustabouts were gathering round curiously, so he grabbed Harry Mike by the arm and drew him across the stage onto the main deck. "I ain't got no time for no long stories," he said when the two of them were reasonably apart from everybody else. "So don't pester me with no questions, you hear? Just do like I tell you." Harry Mike nodded. "Trouble, Captain?" he said, whacking his iron club into a big meaty palm. "How many is back?" Marsh asked. "Most all the crew. Some passengers. Ain't but a few." "We ain't going to wait for no others," Marsh said. "The fewer folks on board, the better. You go hunt up Fram or Albright, I don't care which one, and get them up onto the pilot house, and take us out. Right now, you hear? I'm going to find Mr. Jeffers. After you get a pilot up there, you meet me in the clerk's office. Don't tell anybody what's going on." Between his thick black whiskers, a small grin could be seen. "What we going to do? Buy this steamboat back cheap, maybe?" "No," said Abner Marsh. "No, we're going to kill a man, and not Joshua, neither. Now get on. Meet me in the clerk's office." Jonathan Jeffers wasn't in his office, however, so Marsh had to go round to the head clerk's cabin and pound until a sleepy-looking Jeffers opened the door, still in his nightshirt.
"Captain Marsh," he said, stifling a yawn. "Captain York said you'd sold out." "I didn't think it made much sense, but you weren't around, so I didn't know what to think. Come in." "Tell me what happened last night," Marsh said when he was safely inside the clerk's cabin. Jeffers yawned again.
"Pardon, Captain," he said. "I haven't had much sleep."
He went to the basin perched atop his chest of drawers and splashed some water on his face, fumbled for his spectacles, and came back over to Marsh, looking more like himself.
"Well, let me think a minute. We were at the St. Charles, where I said we'd be. We figured to stay there all night so Captain York and you could have your private dinner." His eyebrow arched sardonically. "Jack Eli was with me, and Carl Fram, and Whitey, and a few of his strikers, and, well, there was a whole bunch of us. Mr. Fram's cub had come along, too. Mr. Albright dined with us, but went up to bed after dinner, while the rest of us stayed up drinking and talking. We had rooms and everything, but no sooner had we gone to bed, must have been 2 or 3 in the morning, when Raymond Ortega and Simon and that sour Billy Tipton character came to bring us back to the steamer. They said York wanted us straight away. Jeffers shrugged. So we came, and Captain York met everyone in the Grand Saloon and said he'd bought you out, and we were leaving sometime in the morning. Some of us were sent out to find those still in New Orleans and notify the passengers. Most of the crew is here now, I believe. I got the freight all signed in and decided to get some sleep. Now, what's really happening? Marsh snorted. I ain't got time, and you wouldn't believe it anyhow. You see anything strange in that saloon last night?
No,
Jeffers said. One eyebrow went up. Should I have? Maybe, said Marsh. Everything was all cleared away from dinner, Jeffers said. It was odd, come to think on it, with the waiters all gone ashore. Sour Billy cleaned it up, I reckon, Marsh said. But it don't matter. Was Julian there? Yes, him and a few others I'd never met before. Captain York had me assign them cabins. That Damon Julian is a strange one. He stayed real close to Captain York. Polite enough, though, and nice-looking, except for that scar. You gave him cabins, you say? Yes, said Jeffers. Captain York said Julian was to have your cabin, but I wouldn't go along with that, not with all your property in there. I insisted he take one of the passenger staterooms along the saloon until I'd had a chance to talk to you. Julian said that would be fine, so there wasn't really any trouble. Abner Marsh grinned. Good, he said. And Sour Billy, where's he? He got the cabin right next to Julian, said Jeffers. But I doubt that he's in it. Last I saw, he was wandering around the main cabin, acting like he owned the boat, and playing with that little knife of his. We had a bit of a run-in. You wouldn't believe what he was doing. He was chucking his knife into one of your fancy colonnades as if it were an old dead tree. I told him to stop or I'd have Harry Mike chuck him over the side. And he did. But he stared at me belligerently. He's trouble, that one. He's still in the main cabin, you think? Well, I've been asleep. But he was there last I saw, sort of dozing in a chair. Get dressed, Abner Marsh told him. Quick-like, and meet me down by your office. Certainly, Captain, Jeffers said, puzzled. And bring your sword cane, Marsh told him as he went out the door. Less than 10 minutes later, he and Jeffers and Harry Mike Dunn were together in the clerk's office. Sit down and keep quiet and listen, Marsh said. This is going to sound crazy, but you two have known me for years, and you damn well know I ain't no half-wit, and I don't go around telling stories like Mr. Fram. This is the goddamn truth, I swear it. May the goddamn boiler blow up underneath me if I'm lying. Abner Marsh took a deep breath and plunged into the story. He told them everything, in one long rush of a speech, stopping only once, when the wild scream of the steamer's whistle interrupted him and the deck began to vibrate. "Pulling out," said Harry Mike. "Going upstream, like you asked." "Good," said Marsh, and he went on with the story while the Fever Dream backed clear of the New Orleans levee, reversed her great paddles, and started back up the Mississippi beneath a hot, clean sun. When Marsh was finished, Jonathan Jeffers looked thoughtful. "Well," he said, "fascinating. Perhaps we should have called in the police." Harry Mike Dunn snorted. "You know better. On the river you handle your own trouble." He hefted his billet. Abner Marsh agreed with him. "This here is my steamboat, and I ain't calling in no outsiders, Mr. Jeffers." That was the way of the river. It was less bother to club a troublemaker and toss him over the side, or leave the paddles to chew him up. The old devil river kept its secrets.
Especially ain't calling in no New Orleans police. They ain't going to care about no colored slave baby. And we ain't even got a body. They're a bunch of scoundrels anyway, and they wouldn't believe us. And if they did, then what? They'd come in with pistols and clubs, worse than useless against Julian and his bunch. So we're to handle it ourselves, Jeffers said. How? I round up the boys, and we kills them all, said Harry Mike amiably. No, said Abner Marsh. Joshua can control the others, I figure. He done it before. He tried to do right to stop what went on last night. Only Julian was too much for him. We just got to get rid of Julian before dark. Ain't gonna be hard, offered Harry Mike. Abner Marsh scowled. I ain't so sure of that, he said. This ain't like the stories. They ain't helpless by day. They're only sleeping. And if you wake 'em up, they're awful strong and awful fast. And they ain't never easy to hurt. This has to be done right. I reckon the three of us can handle it. No sense getting others involved. If anything goes wrong, we'll get everybody off this steamer well before dark and put in someplace upriver where nobody can interfere, where none of the night folks can get away if it comes to having to kill more than just Julian. Don't think it will, though. Marsh looked at Jeffers. You got the duplicate key to that cabin you put Julian in? And my safe, the clerk said, pointing towards the black iron strongbox with his sword cane. Good, said Marsh. Mike, how hard can you hit with that thing of yours? Harry Mike smiled and thwacked the iron billet into his palm. It made a satisfactorily loud sound. How hard you want me to hit, Captain? I want you to crush his goddamn head in, Marsh said. And you got to do it right off, with one swing. Ain't going to be time for no second try. You just break his nose for him, and a second later he's going to be up tearing out your throat. One hit, said Harry Mike. Just one. Abner Marsh nodded, confident that the huge mate was true to his word. Only one more problem, then. Sour Billy. He's Julian's little watchdog. Maybe he's dozing in some chair, but I'll wager he'll wake up quick enough if he sees us going for Julian's door. Though he ain't going to see us. Those boiler deck cabins got two doors. If Billy is in the saloon, we go in from the promenade. If he's outside, we go in from the saloon. Before we do anything, we make sure we know where Billy is. That's your job, Mr. Jeffers. You're going to find Mr. Sour Billy Tipton for us and tell us where he is. And then you're to make sure he don't go wandering. If he hears a ruckus or heads for Julian's cabin, I want you to take that sword cane of yours and stick it clean through his sour little belly. You hear? Understood, the clerk said grimly. He adjusted his spectacles. Abner Marsh paused a moment and looked hard at his two allies. The slim dandy of a clerk in his gold specs and button gaiters, his mouth tight, his hair as neatly slicked back as ever, and beside him, the huge mate with his rough clothing and his rough face and his rough ways, his green eyes hard and spoiling for a fight. They were a strange pair, but a most formidable one, Abner Marsh thought. He snorted, satisfied. Well, what are we waiting for? He asked. Mr. Jeffers, you go find where Sour Billy is at. The clerk rose and brushed himself off. Certainly, he said. He was back in under 5 minutes. He's in the main cabin, sitting to breakfast. The whistle must have wakened him. He's eating eggs and boiled beef cakes and drinking plenty of coffee. And he's sitting where he can see the door to Julian's cabin. Good, Marsh said. Mr. Jeffers? Why don't you go break fast yourself? Jeffers smiled. I do believe I have a sudden appetite. The keys first, though. Jeffers nodded and bent to his safe. Keys in hand, Marsh gave the clerk a good 10 minutes to find his way back to the Grand Saloon before he stood and took a deep breath. His heart was thumping. Come on, he said to Harry Mike Dunn, opening the door to the world outside. The day was bright and hot, which Marsh took for a good omen. The fever dream was surging up the river easy as you please,
her wake a churning double line of white-flecked foam. She must be doing 18 miles an hour, Marsh thought, riding smooth as a Creole's manners. He found himself wondering what her time to Natchez would be, and all of a sudden he wanted to be up in her pilot house more than anything, looking out on the river he loved so well. Abner Marsh swallowed and blinked back tears, feeling sick and unmanly. "Captain?" Harry Mike said uncertainly. Abner Marsh cussed. "It's nothing," he said. "It's just... God damn it all. Come on." He stomped off, the key to Damon Julian's cabin clenched tightly in a huge red hand. His knuckles were turning white. Outside the cabin, Marsh paused to look around. The promenade was mostly empty. A lady was standing by the railing a good ways aft of them, and about a dozen doors forward there was a fellow in a white shirt and a slouchy hat sitting with his chair tilted back against a stateroom door, but neither of them seemed much interested in Marsh and Harry Mike. Marsh slid the key carefully into the hole. "You remember what I told you," he whispered to the mate. "Quick and quiet. One hit." Harry Mike nodded, and Marsh turned the key. The door clicked open, and Marsh pushed. It was close and dark inside, everything curtained and shuttered, the way the night folks liked their rooms. But they saw a pale form sprawled beneath the sheet by the light that spilled in from the door. They slid through, moving as quietly as two big noisy men could move. And then Marsh was closing the door behind them, and Harry Mike Dunn was moving forward, raising his 3-foot-long black iron billet high over his head. And dimly Marsh saw the thing in the bed stir, rolling over toward the noise, toward the light. And Harry Mike was there in 2 long, quick strides, all so fast, and the iron fell in a terrible arc at the end of his huge arm. Fell and fell toward that dim, pale head, and it seemed to take forever. Then the cabin door shut completely. The last thread of light snapped, and in the blind, pitch darkness, Abner Marsh heard a sound like a piece of meat being slapped down on a butcher's counter, and under that was another sound, like an eggshell breaking, and Marsh held his breath. The cabin was very still, and Marsh could not see a thing. From the darkness came a low, throaty chuckle. A cold sweat covered Marsh's body. "Mike," he whispered. He fumbled for a match.
"Yes, sir, Captain," came the mate's voice. "One hit, that's all."
He chuckled again. Abner Marsh scratched the match on the wall and blinked. Harry Mike was standing over the bed, his iron in hand. The business end was smeared and wet. The thing beneath the sheet had a staved-in red ruin for a face. Half the top of its skull had been taken away, and a slow trickle of blood was soaking into the sheet. Bits of hair and other dark stuff were spattered on the pillow and the wall, and Harry Mike's clothes.
"Is he dead?"
Marsh asked, suddenly and wildly suspicious that the smashed-in head would begin to knit itself together, and the pale corpse would rise and smile at them.
"I ain't never seen nothing deader," said Harry Mike.
"Make sure," Abner Marsh ordered. "Make damn sure."
Harry Mike Dunn shrugged, a big, slow shrug, and raised his bloody iron and brought it down again onto the skull and pillow. A second time, a third, a fourth. When it was over, the thing hardly could be said to have a head at all. Harry Mike Dunn was an awful strong man. The match burned Marsh's fingers. He blew it out. "Let's go," he said harshly.
"What'll we do with him?" Harry Mike asked.
Marsh pulled open the cabin door. The sun and the river were before him. A blessed relief.
"Leave him there," he said. "In the dark. Come nightfall, we'll chuck him in the river."
The mate followed Marsh outside, and he locked the door behind him. He felt sick. He leaned his ample bulk up against the boiler deck railing and struggled to keep from heaving over the side. Bloodsucker or not, what they'd gone and done to Damon Julian was terrible to behold.
"Need help, Captain?"
"No," said Marsh.
He straightened himself with an effort. The morning was already hot, the yellow sun above beating down on the river with an almighty vengeance. Marsh was drenched with sweat.
"I ain't had much sleep," he said.
He forced a laugh. I ain't had none, in fact. It takes a bit out of a man, too, what we just done. Harry Mike shrugged. It hadn't taken much out of him, it seemed. Go sleep, he said. No, said Marsh. Can't. Got to go see Joshua. Tell him what we done. He's got to know, so he'll be ready to deal with them others. All of a sudden, Abner Marsh found himself wondering just how Joshua York would react to the brutal murder of one of his people. After last night, he couldn't think Joshua would be too bothered, but he wasn't sure. He didn't really know the night folks, and how they thought. And if Julian had been a baby killer and a bloodsucker, well, the rest of them had done things near as bad, even Joshua. And Damon Julian had been Joshua's bloodmaster, too, the king of the vampires. If you kill a man's king, even a king he hates, ain't he obliged to do something about it? Abner Marsh remembered the cold force of Joshua's anger, and with that memory found himself none too eager to go rushing on up to the captain's cabin on the Texas, especially now when Joshua would be at his worst once roused. Maybe I can wait, Marsh found himself saying. Sleep a little. Harry Mike nodded. I got to get to Joshua first, though, Marsh said. He really was feeling sick, he thought, nauseated, feverish, weary. He had to go lie down for a couple of hours. Can't let him get up. He licked his lips, which were dry as sandpaper. You go talk to Jeffers. Tell him how it come out. And one of you come and fetch me before sunset. Well before, you hear? Give me at least an hour to go on up and speak to Joshua. I'll wake him up and tell him, and then when it gets dark, he'll know how to handle the other night folks. And you have one of your boys keep a sharp eye on Sour Billy. We're going to have to deal with him, too. Harry Mike smiled. Let the river deal with him. Maybe we will, said Marsh. Maybe. I'm going to rest now, but make sure I'm up before dark. Don't you go let it get dark on me, you understand? Yep. So Abner Marsh climbed wearily up to the Texas, feeling sicker and more tired with every step. Standing at the door of his own cabin, he felt a sudden stab of fear. What if one of them should be inside after all, despite what Mr. Jeffers had said? But when he threw the door open and let the light come pouring into the room, it was empty. Marsh staggered in, drew the curtains back, and opened the window to let in as much light and air as possible, locked the door, and sat heavily on the bed to remove his sweat-soaked clothing. He didn't even bother with a nightshirt. The cabin was stifling, but Marsh was too exhausted to notice. Sleep took him almost at once. Chapter 19 Aboard the steamer Fever Dream, Mississippi River, August 1857. The sharp, insistent rapping on his cabin door finally summoned Abner Marsh back from his deep, dreamless sleep. He stirred groggily and sat up in bed. "A minute!" he shouted. He lumbered over to his basin like a big, naked bear just out of hibernation, and none too happy about it. It wasn't until Marsh had splashed some water on his face that he remembered. God damn it all to hell, he swore angrily, staring at the gray shadows gathering in every corner of the small dim cabin. Beyond the window, the sky was dark and purple. God damn, he repeated, pulling on a pair of clean trousers. He stomped over and yanked open the door. What the hell is the meaning of letting me sleep so long? Marsh shouted at Jonathan Jeffers. I told Harry Mike to wake me a whole goddamn hour before sunset, damn it. It is an hour before sunset, Jeffers said. It clouded up. That's why it looks so dark. Mr. Albright says we're going to get another thunderstorm. The clerk stepped into Marsh's cabin and shut the door behind him. I brought you this, he said, handing over a hickory walking stick. I found it in the main cabin, Captain. Marsh took the stick, mollified. I lost it last night, he said. Had other things on my mind. He leaned the stick up against the wall and glanced out the window again, frowning. Beyond the river, the whole western horizon was a mass of threatening clouds moving their way, like a vast wall of darkness about to collapse on them. The setting sun was nowhere to be seen. He didn't like it one bit. "I better get on up to Joshua," he said, pulling out a shirt and commencing the business of getting dressed. Jeffers leaned on his sword cane. "Shall I accompany you?" he asked. "I ought to talk to Joshua by myself," Marsh said, tying his tie with an eye on the mirror. "I don't relish it, though. Why don't you come on up and wait outside? Maybe Joshua will want to call you in and talk about what we're going to do." Left unspoken was the other reason that Marsh wanted the clerk close at hand. Maybe he'd want to call him in, if Joshua York didn't take kindly to the news of Damon Julian's demise. "Fine," said Jeffers. Marsh shrugged into his captain's coat and snatched up his stick. "Let's go then, Mr. Jeffers. It's too damn dark already." The Fever Dream was steaming along briskly, her flags snapping and swirling in a strong wind, dark smoke pouring from her chimneys. Under the scant light of the strange purple sky, the waters of the Mississippi looked almost black. Marsh grimaced and strode forward briskly to Joshua York's cabin, Jeffers at his side. This time he did not hesitate at the door. He raised his stick and knocked. On the third knock he called out, "Joshua, let me in. We got to talk." On the fifth knock the door opened, moving slowly inward to reveal a soft, still blackness. "Wait for me," Marsh said to Jeffers. He stepped into the cabin and closed the door. "Don't get mad now, Joshua," he said to the dark, with a tight feeling in his gut. "I wouldn't bother you, but this is important, and it's almost night anyhow." There was no reply, though Marsh heard the sound of breathing. "God damn it," he said. "Why do we always have to talk in the dark, Joshua? It makes me damn uncomfortable." He frowned. "Light a candle, will you?" "No." The voice was curt, low, liquid, and it was not Joshua's. Abner Marsh took a step backward. "Oh, Jesus God, no," he said. And there was a rustling sound, even as his shaking hand found the door behind him and threw it open. He opened it wide, and by now his eyes had accustomed themselves to the darkness, and even the purplish glow of the storm-laden sky was enough to give brief form to the shadows within the captain's cabin. He saw Joshua York sprawled on his bed, pale and naked, his eyes closed, one arm hanging down to the floor, and on his wrist was something that looked like a terrible dark bruise, or a crust of dried blood. And he saw Damon Julian moving toward him, swift as death, smiling. "We killed you," Marsh roared, disbelieving, and he stumbled backward out of the cabin, tripped and fell practically at Jonathan Jeffers' feet. Julian stopped in the doorway. A thin, dark line, hardly more than a cat scratch, ran down his cheek where Marsh had opened a yawning gash the night before. Otherwise, he was unmarked. He had taken off his jacket and vest, and his ruffled silk shirt was without stain or blemish. "Come in, Captain," Julian said quietly. "Don't run away. Come in and talk." "You're dead. Mike bashed your goddamn head to pieces," Marsh said, choking on his own words. He did not look at Julian's eyes. It was still day, he thought. He was safe outside, beyond Julian's reach, until the sun went down, so long as he did not look in those eyes, so long as he did not go back into that cabin. "Dead?" Julian smiled. "Ah, the other cabin. Poor Jean. He wanted so to believe Joshua. And see what you have done to him. Smashed his head in, did you say?" Abner Marsh climbed to his feet. "You changed cabins," he said hoarsely. "You damn devil. You made him sleep in your bed." "Joshua and I had so much to discuss," Julian replied. He made a beckoning gesture. "Now come, Captain. I am tired of waiting. Come and let us drink together." "Burn in hell," Marsh said. "Maybe we missed you this morning, but you ain't got away yet. Mr. Jeffers, run on down and get Harry Mike and his boys. A dozen of them ought to do, I reckon." "No," said Damon Julian. "You won't do that." Marsh waved his stick threateningly.
Oh, yes, I will. You going to stop me?
Julian glanced up at the sky, a deep violet now, shot through with black, a vast, bruised, and overcast twilight.
Yes, he said,
and he stepped out into the light. Abner Marsh felt the cold, clammy hand of terror close around his heart. He raised his walking stick and said,
"Stay away!"
in a voice gone suddenly shrill. He stepped backward. Damon Julian smiled and came on. It wasn't light enough, Marsh thought with sick despair. And then there was a whisper of metal on wood, and Jonathan Jeffers stepped smoothly in front of him, his sword cane unsheathed, the sharp steel circling dangerously.
"Go for help, Captain,"
Jeffers said quietly. He pushed up his spectacles with his free hand.
"I'll keep Mr. Julian occupied."
Lightly, with a fencer's practiced speed, Jeffers darted forward at Julian, slashing. His blade was a rapier, double-edged and wickedly pointed. Damon Julian reeled back, barely in time, his smile fading from his lips as the clerk's slash passed inches in front of his face.
"Step aside," Julian said darkly.
Jonathan Jeffers said nothing. He was in a fencer's stance, advancing slowly on the balls of his feet, crowding Julian back toward the door of the captain's cabin. He thrust suddenly, but Julian was too fast, sliding backward out of the reach of the sword. Jeffers made an impatient... Damon Julian set one foot back inside the cabin and answered with a laugh that was almost a snarl. His white hands rose and opened. Jeffers thrust again. And Julian lunged, hands extended. Abner Marsh saw it all. Jeffers' thrust was true, and Julian made no effort to avoid it. The rapier entered him just above the groin. Julian's pale face twisted, and a grunt of pain escaped him. But he came on. Jeffers ran him clean through even as Julian ran up the blade, and before the startled clerk had time to pull back, Julian had wrapped his hands around Jeffers' throat. Jeffers made a horrible choking sound, and his eyes bulged, and as he tried to wrench free, his gold-rimmed spectacles spun off and fell to the deck. Marsh leaped forward and smashed Julian with his stick, raining blows around his head and shoulders. Transfixed by the sword, Julian hardly seemed to feel it. He twisted savagely, and there was a noise like wood snapping. Jeffers went limp. Abner Marsh whipped his stick around in one final blow with all his strength in it and caught Damon Julian square in the center of his forehead, staggering him briefly. When Julian opened his hands, Jeffers fell like a rag doll, his head twisted around grotesquely so it almost seemed it was on backwards. Abner Marsh retreated hurriedly. Julian touched his brow, as if gauging the effects of Marsh's blow. There was no blood, Marsh saw dismally. Strong as he was, he was no Harry Mike Dunn, and Hickory was not iron. Damon Julian kicked loose Jeffers' death grip from the handle of the sword cane. Wincing, he drew the blood-slick blade awkwardly out of his own body. His shirt and trousers were damp and red, and stuck to him when he moved. He spun the blade off to one side almost casually, and it whipped round and round like a top as it sailed off over the river, before vanishing into the dark moving water. Julian staggered forward again, leaving bloody footsteps behind him on the deck, but he came. Marsh retreated before him. There was no killing him, he thought, in a blind, sick panic. There is nothing to be done. Joshua and his dreams, Harry Mike and his iron billet, Mr. Jeffers and his sword, none of them could take the measure of this Damon Julian. Marsh scrambled down the short stairway to the hurricane deck and began to run. Panting, he hurried aft to the companionway leaning down from the hurricane deck to the promenade, where he'd find people and safety. It was nearly dark, he saw. He took three thunderous steps downstairs, then gripped the handrail tightly and reeled, trying to check himself. Sour Billy Tipton and four of them were climbing toward him. Abner Marsh turned and ascended. Rush forward and ring the bell, he thought wildly. Ring the bell for help. But Julian had come down from the Texas deck now and cut him off. For a moment Marsh stood dead with despair. He had no escape. He was trapped between Julian and the others, unarmed except for his useless goddamn stick. And it didn't matter. Nothing hurt them anyway. Fighting was useless. He might as well give in. Julian wore a thin, cruel smile as he advanced. In his mind, Marsh saw that pale face descending on his own, teeth bared, those eyes bright with fever and thirst, red and ancient and invincible. If he'd had tears, Marsh might have wept. He found he could not move his legs from where they were rooted, and even his stick seemed far too heavy. Then, far up the river, another sidewheeler came round a bend, and Abner Marsh would never have noticed, but the pilot did, and the steam whistle of the Fever Dream called out to tell the other steamer that she'd take the larboard when they passed. The shrill wail of the great whistle stirred Marsh from his paralysis, and he looked up and saw the far-off lights of the descending boat, and the fires belching from the tops of her tall chimneys, and the near black sky that loomed above it, and the lightning dim in the distance, lighting up the clouds from within, and the river black and endless, the river that was his home and his trade, and his friend and his worst enemy, and fickle, brutal, loving consort to his ladies. It flowed on like it always flowed, and it didn't know nothing nor care nothing about Damon Julian and all his kind. They were nothing to it. They would be gone and forgotten, and the old devil river would still be rolling and cutting new channels and drowning towns and crops and raising up others and crushing steamboats in its teeth, but could spit out splinters. Abner Marsh moved to where the tops of the great paddle boxes loomed above the deck. Julian came following him. "Captain!" he called, his voice twisted but still seductive. Marsh ignored it. He pulled himself up on top of the paddle box with a strength born of urgency, a strength he didn't know he had. Beneath his feet the great side wheel turned. He could feel it shaking through the wood, could hear the chunka-chunka. He moved aft carefully, not wanting to fall in the wrong place, where the wheels would suck him under and smash him up. He looked down. The light was almost gone, and the water seemed black, but where the Fever Dream had gone it was boiling and churning. The glow from the steamer's furnaces touched it with red, so it looked like boiling blood. Abner Marsh stared down at it and froze. More blood, he thought. More goddamn blood. Can't get away from it. Can't get away nohow. The pounding of the steamer's stroke was thunder in his ears. Sour Billy Tipton vaulted up on top of the paddle box and moved warily toward him. "Mr. Julian wants you, fat man," he said. "Come along, now. You've gone as far as you can go." He took out his little knife and smiled. Sour Billy Tipton had a truly frightening smile. "It ain't blood," Marsh said loudly. "It's just a goddamn river." Still clutching his stick, he took a deep breath and threw himself off the steamer. Sour Billy's curses were ringing in his ears when he hit the water. Chapter 20. Aboard the steamer Fever Dream, Mississippi River, August 1857. Raymond and Armand were supporting Damon Julian between them when Sour Billy leaped down from the paddle box. Julian looked like he'd slaughtered a pig. His clothing was soaked through with blood. "You allowed him to escape, Billy," he said coldly. His tone made Sour Billy nervous. "He's finished," Billy insisted. "Them paddles will suck him under and smash him, or he'll drown. You ought to have seen the splash he made when he hit the water. That big belly of his first. Ain't going to have to look at his warts no more." As he spoke, Sour Billy was looking around, and he didn't like what he saw, not one bit. Julian, all bloody, a red, smeary trail leading down the Texas stairs and halfway down the hurricane deck. And that dandy of a clerk hanging off the end of the Texas porch, more blood coming out of his mouth. "If you fail me, Billy, you will never be as we are," Julian said. "I hope he is dead, for your sake. Do you understand?" "Yes," said Billy. "Mr. Julian, what happened?" "They attacked me, Billy. They attacked us. According to the good captain, they killed Jean, bashed his goddamn head to pieces, I believe that was the phrase." He smiled. "Marsh and his wretch of a clerk and someone named Mike
were responsible. Harry Mike Dunn, said Raymond Ortega. He is the mate of the Fever Dream, Damon. Large, stupid, and uncouth. It is his job to shout at the darkies and beat them.
Ah, Julian said. Let me go, he said to Raymond and Armand. I feel stronger now. I can stand.
The twilight had deepened. They stood in shadow. Damon, warned Vincent, the watch will change at supper. Crewmen will be coming up to their cabins. We must do something. We must get off this steamer, or they will find us out. He looked at the blood, the body.
No, said Julian.
Billy will clean it up, won't you, Billy?
Yes, said Sour Billy. I'll just toss the clerk and after his captain.
Do it then, Billy, instead of telling me about it. Julian's smile was cold. And then come to York's cabin. We will retire there now. I need a change of clothes. It took Sour Billy Tipton nearly 20 minutes to remove the evidence of the death on the Texas. He worked in haste, all too aware of how easy it would be for someone to come out of his cabin or up the stairs. The darkness was almost complete by then, however, which helped. He dragged Jeffers' body down the deck, hauled it up on the paddle box with some difficulty. The clerk was heavier than Billy ever would have guessed, and shoved it over. The night and the river swallowed it, and the splash wasn't nearly as big as the one Marsh had made. It was almost lost in the sound of the paddle wheels. Sour Billy had just stripped off his shirt and started cleaning up the blood when he had a stroke of luck. The storm that had been coming all afternoon finally broke. Thunder boomed in his ears, lightning came stabbing down at the river, and the rains began. Clean, cold, pounding rains, smashing down onto the deck, soaking Billy through to his bones and washing away the blood. Sour Billy was dripping when he finally entered Joshua York's cabin, his once fine shirt a damp ball in his hand. It's done, he said. Damon Julian was sitting in a deep leather chair. He had changed into some fresh clothing, had a drink in hand, and looked as strong and healthy as ever. Raymond was standing at his side. Armand was in the other chair. Vincent was seated on the desk, Kurt in the desk chair. And Joshua York sat on his bed, staring down at his feet, head sunk, his skin white as chalk dust. He looked like a whipped cur, thought Sour Billy.
Ah, Billy, said Julian, whatever would we do without you?
Sour Billy nodded.
I've been thinking while I was out there, Mr. Julian, he said. The way I figure, we got two choices. This here steamer has a yaw for doing soundings and such. We could take her and light out. Or now that the storm's broke, we could just wait till the pilot ties her up and then get ashore. We ain't far from Bayou Sarah. Maybe we'll put in there. I have no interest in Bayou Sarah, Billy. I have no interest in leaving this excellent steamboat. The Fever Dream is ours now. Isn't that right, Joshua?
Joshua York raised his head.
Yes, he said.
His voice was so weak it was hardly audible.
It's too dangerous, Sour Billy insisted. The captain and the head clerk both gone. What are people going to think?
They're going to be missed. Questions are going to get asked. Real soon now, too.
He is right, Damon, Raymond put in. I have been aboard this steamer since Natchez. The passengers may come and go, but the crew... We are in danger here. We are the strange ones, suspected, unknown. When Marsh and Jeffers are missed, they will look to us first. And then there's this mate, added Billy. If he helped Marsh, he knows everything, Mr. Julian.
Kill him, Billy. Sour Billy Tipton swallowed uneasily.
Suppose I do kill him, Mr. Julian. Won't do no good. He'll be missed, too. And there's others under him, a whole damn army of niggers and dumb Germans and big Swedes. We got less than 20. And during the day, there's only me. We got to get off this steamboat, and real quick, too. We can't fight the crew, and even if we could, I sure can't fight them all alone, all by myself. We got to go.
We are staying. It is for them to fear us, Billy. How can you ever be one of the masters if you still think as a slave? We are staying. What will we do when Marsh and Jeffers are found gone? Asked Vincent. And what about the mate? He is a threat, said Kurt. Damon Julian stared at Sour Billy and smiled. Ah, he said. He sipped his drink. Why, we will let Billy take care of these little problems for us. Billy will show us how clever he is, won't you, Billy? Me? Sour Billy Tipton stood open-mouthed. I don't know. Won't you, Billy? Yes, Billy said quickly. Yes. I can solve this without further bloodshed, Joshua York said with a hint of his old resolve in his voice. I am still captain aboard this steamer. Let me discharge Mr. Dunn and any of the others that you may fear. We can get them off the fever dream cleanly. There has been enough death. Has there? Asked Julian. Firing them won't work, Dora Billy said to York. They'll only wonder why and demand to see Captain Marsh. Yes, agreed Raymond. They don't follow York, he added to Julian. They don't trust him. He had to come out in broad daylight before any of them would agree to go down the bayou with him. With Marsh gone, and Jeffers too, he will never be able to control them. Sour Billy Tipton looked at Joshua York with surprise and new respect. You did that? He blurted. Went out by day? The others sometimes dared the dusk, or lingered a short time after sunrise, but he had never seen any of them come out when the sun was high, not even Julian. Joshua York looked at him coldly and did not answer. Dear Joshua likes to play at being cattle, Julian said, amused. Perhaps he hoped his skin would turn brown and leathery. The others laughed politely. While they were laughing, Sour Billy got himself an idea. He scratched his head and let himself smile. We won't fire them, he said suddenly to Julian. I know. We'll make them run off. I know just how to do it. Good, Billy. Whatever would we do without you? Can you make him do like I tell him? Billy asked, jerking a thumb in York's direction. I will do what I must to protect my people, Joshua York said. And to protect my crew as well. There is no need for compulsion. Well, well, said Sour Billy. Real nice. This was going to be even easier than he'd figured. Julian would be real impressed. I got to get me a new shirt. You get dressed, Mr. Captain York, and then we'll do us some protecting. Yes, Julian added softly. And Kurt will go with you as well. He raised his glass to York. Just in case. A half hour later, Sour Billy led Joshua York and Kurt down to the boiler deck. The rain had let up a little, and the fever dream had put in at Bayou Sara and was tied up next to a dozen smaller steamers. In the main saloon, supper had been served. Julian and his people were in there with the rest, eating inconspicuously. The captain's chair was empty, though, and someone was bound to comment sooner or later. Fortunately, Harry Mike Dunn was down below on the main deck, bellowing at the rosters as they loaded up some freight and a dozen cords of wood. Sour Billy had watched him carefully from above before starting in on his plan. Dunn was the dangerous one. The body first, Sour Billy said, leading them straight to the outer door of the cabin where Jean Ardunt had met his end. Kurt broke the lock with a single swing of his hand. Inside, Billy lit the lamp, and they took in the thing on the bed. Sour Billy Tipton whistled. Well, well, he said. Those friends of yours sure did a job on old Jean, he said to York. Half his brains is on the sheets and half is on the wall. York's gray eyes were full of disgust. Get on with it, he said. I suppose you want us to throw the body in the river? Hell no, said Sour Billy. Why, we're going to burn this body. Right down in one of your furnaces, Captain. And we're not sneaking it down, neither.
We'll just go right on out into the saloon with it and down the main staircase.
Why, Billy? York said coldly.
Just do it, Sour Billy snapped.
And I'm Mr. Tipton to you, Captain.
They wrapped Jean's corpse in a sheet, so nothing could be seen of it. York went to help Kurt lift it, but Sour Billy chased him off and took up the other end himself.
Wouldn't look right for a half-owner and captain to be a totin' a dead man. You just walk along with us and look worried.
York didn't have trouble with the looking worried part. They opened the door to the grand saloon and went out. Jean's sheeted body between Billy and Kurt. The supper table was half full. Someone gasped, and all conversation stopped.
"Can I help, Captain York?"
asked a small man with white whiskers and oil stains on his vest.
"What is it? Somebody die?" "Stay away,"
Sour Billy shouted when the man took a step toward them.
"Do as he says, Whitey," York said.
The man stopped.
"Why, sure, but it's just a dead man," Sour Billy said. "Died in his cabin. Mr. Jeffers found him. He got on at New Orleans. Must have been sick. He was burning up when Jeffers heard him moaning."
Everyone at the table looked concerned. One man turned very pale and fled toward his own stateroom. Sour Billy made certain not to smile.
"Where's Mr. Jeffers?"
asked Albright, the trim little pilot.
"Went to his cabin," Billy said quickly. "He wasn't feeling good. Marsh is with him. Mr. Jeffers was looking kind of yaller. I reckon seeing a man die didn't agree with him."
His words had the effect he'd figured on, especially when Armand leaned across the table to Vincent and said, in a loud whisper like Billy had told him to,
"Bronze John."
Then the two of them got up and left, their suppers half eaten.
"It ain't Bronze John," Billy said loudly.
He had to say it loudly because all of a sudden everybody at this table was trying to talk, and half of them were getting to their feet.
"We got to go burn this body. Come on now," he added,
and he and Kurt started shuffling toward the grand staircase again. Joshua York lingered behind, hands upraised, trying to fend off 100 frightened questions. Passengers and crew alike avoided Kurt and Billy and their burden. A couple of scroungy-looking foreigners taking deck passage were the only ones down on the main deck, except for the rousters coming in and out with crates and firewood. The furnaces had been shut down, but they were still hot, and Sour Billy burned his fingers when he and Kurt stuffed the sheeted body into the nearest one. He was still swearing and shaking his hand in the air when Joshua came down and found him again. "They're leaving," York said, his pale features puzzled. "Nearly all the passengers are already packing their bags, and half the crew must have come up to me to ask for their wages. Strikers, chambermaids, waiters, even Jack Eli, the second engineer. I don't understand."
"Bronze John is taking a ride up the river on your steamer,"
Sour Billy Tipton said. "Leastwise, that's what they think." Joshua York frowned.
"Bronze John?"
Sour Billy smiled.
"Yaller fever, Captain. I can tell you never been in New Orleans when Bronze John made a call. Ain't nobody going to stay on this boat longer than he has to, nor look close at this body, nor go to talk with Jeffers or Marsh. I let 'em think they got the fever, you see. The fever is real catching. Fast, too. You turn yaller and heave up black stuff and burn like the devil, and then you die. Only now we better burn up old Jean here so they think we're taking this serious."
It took them 10 minutes to get the furnace going again, and they finally had to call over a big Swedish fireman to help them. But that was all right. Sour Billy saw his eyes when he spied the body crammed in with the wood, and smiled at how fast he run off. Pretty soon Jean was going good. Sour Billy watched him smoke, then turned away bored. He noticed the barrels of lard standing near the hand.
"Use that for racing, do you?"
he asked Joshua York. York nodded. Sour Billy spat.
"Down here, when a captain gets into the race and needs some more steam, He just has him chuck in a nice fat nigger. Lard's too expensive. You see, I know something about steamers, too. Too bad we couldn't save Gene for a race. Kurt smiled at that. But Joshua York only stared, glowering. Our Billy didn't like that look, not one bit. But before he could say anything, he heard the voice he'd been waiting for. You! Harry Mike Dunn came swaggering in from the forecastle, all 6 foot of him. Rain was dripping off the wide brim of his black felt hat, and moisture beaded his black whiskers, and his clothes were stuck to his body. His eyes were hard little green marbles, and he had his iron club in hand, smacking it up against his palm threateningly. Behind him stood a dozen deckhands, stokers, and roustabouts. The big Swede was there, and an even bigger nigger with one ear, and a wiry mulatto with a two-by-four, and a couple guys with knives. The mate came closer, and the others followed him. "Who you burning in there, boy?" he roared. "What's all this about yaller fever? Ain't no yaller fever on this boat." "Do like I told you," Sour Billy said to York in a low, urgent voice. He backed away from the furnace as the mate advanced. Joshua York stepped between them and raised his hands. "Stop," he said. "Mr. Dunn, I'm discharging you here and now. You are no longer mate of the Fever Dream." Dunn eyed him suspiciously. "Ain't I?" he said. Then he grimaced. "Hell, you ain't firing me." "I am the master and captain here." "Is you? Well, I takes orders from Captain Marsh. He tells me to get, I get. Till then, I stay. And don't tell me no lies about buying him out. Heard them lies this morning." He took another step forward. "Now, you get out of the way, Captain. I'm going to get me some answers from Mr. Sour Billy here." "Mr. Dunn, there is sickness aboard this steamer. I am discharging you for your own safety." Joshua York lied with real nice sincerity, Sour Billy thought. "Mr. Tipton will be the new mate. He's already been exposed." "Him?" The iron billet smacked against the mate's palm. "He ain't no steamboater." "Been an overseer," Billy said. "I can handle niggers." He moved forward again. Harry Mike Dunn laughed. Sour Billy felt cold all over. If there was one thing in the world that he could not stand, it was being laughed at. Right then and there, he decided not to scare Dunn off after all. Killing him would be much nicer. "You got all them niggers and white trash behind you," he said to the mate. "Looks to me like you're scared to face me by yourself." Dunn's green eyes narrowed dangerously, and he smacked his club into his palm even harder than before. He came forward 2 quick steps into the full glare of the furnace and stood there, awash in the hellish glow, peering in at the burning corpse. Finally, he turned to face Sour Billy again. "Only him in there," he said. "That's good for you. If it had been the captain or Jeffers, I was going to break every bone in your body before I killed you. Now I'm just going to kill you right off." "No," Joshua York said. He stepped in front of the mate again. "Get off my steamer," he said. "You're discharged." Harry Mike Dunn shoved him out of the way. "Stay out of this, Captain. Fair fight, just me and him. If he whips me, he's mate. Only I'm going to bash his head in. And then you and me'll go find Captain Marsh and see who leaves this here steamboat." Sour Billy reached behind him and pulled out his knife. Joshua York looked from one to the other in despair. The other men had all drawn back now and were calling out encouragement to Harry Mike. Kurt moved forward smoothly and pulled York out of the way to keep him from interfering. Bathed in the furnace light, Harry Mike Dunn looked like something straight out of hell. Smoke curling up around him, his skin flushed and reddish, the water drying on his hair, his club smacking against his palm as he advanced. He smiled. "I fought boys with knives before," he said, punctuating his words with smacks. "Lots of dirty little boys." Smack. "I've been cut before, too." Smack. "Cuts heal up, Sour Billy." Smack.
Bust heads? That's another thing. Smack. Smack. Smack.
Billy had been steadily retreating until his back came up hard against a stack of crates. The knife was loose in his hand. Hairy Mike saw him cornered and grinned. Raising the iron billet high overhead, he came forward roaring. And Sour Billy Tipton tossed the knife in his hand and sent it slicing through the air. It caught Hairy Mike right under his chin, driving up through his whiskers and into his head. He went to his knees, and blood came pouring out of his mouth. And then he pitched forward onto the deck.
"Well, well," Sour Billy said, sauntering over to the body. He kicked it in the head and smiled. For the niggers and the foreigners and for Kurt, but mostly for Joshua York.
"Well, well," he repeated. "Guess that makes me mate."
Chapter 21, St. Louis, September 1857. Abner Marsh slammed the door behind him when he came stomping into the Pine Street office of the Fever River Packet Company.
"Where is she?"
Marsh demanded, striding across the room and leaning on the desk to stare down at the startled agent. A fly buzzed around his head, and Marsh brushed it away impatiently.
"I said, where is she?"
The agent was a gaunt, dark young man in a striped shirt and a green eyeshade. He was very flustered.
"Why," he said, "why, Captain Marsh, why, it's a pleasure. I never thought, that is, we didn't expect you. No, sir, Captain, not a bit. Is the fever dream come in, Captain?"
Abner Marsh snorted, straightened, and stamped his walking stick on the bare wooden floor in disgust.
"Mr. Green," he said, "quit your goddamn babbling and pay attention now. I asked you, where is she?"
"Now, what do you think I was asking about, Mr. Green?" The agent swallowed.
"I reckon I don't know, Captain." "The fever dream,"
Marsh bellowed, red in the face.
"I want to know where she is. She ain't down by the landing, I know that much, I got eyes. And I didn't see her anywhere along the goddamn river. Did she come in and leave again? Did she steam up to St. Paul or the Missouri? The Ohio? Don't look so damn thunderstruck, just tell me, where's my goddamn steamer?"
"I don't know, Captain," said Green. "I mean, if you didn't bring her in, I got no idea. She's never been in St. Louis, not since you took her down the river back in July. But we heard, we..."
"Yes, what?"
"The fever, sir. We heard yellow fever broke out on the fever dream down to Bayou Sarah. Folks were dying like flies, we heard, just like flies. Mr. Jeffers and you, we heard you had it too. That's why I never expected, with everyone dying and all, we thought they'd burn her, Captain. The steamer."
He slipped off his eyeshade and scratched his head. "I guess you got over the fever, Captain. Glad to hear it. Only, if the fever dream ain't with you, where is she? Are you sure you didn't come in on her and maybe forget? I hear the fever can make a man awful absent-minded."
Abner Marsh scowled.
"I ain't had the fever, and I sure as hell can tell one steamboat from another, Mr. Green. I came in on the Princess. I was sick for a week or so, all right, but it was no fever. I had the chills on account of falling in the goddamn river and almost drowning. That's how I lost the fever dream. And now I aim to find her again, you hear me?"
He snorted.
"Where'd you hear all this stuff about yellow fever?"
"The crew, Captain. The ones who left her down in Bayou Sarah. Some of them came in when they arrived in St. Louis, oh, about a week ago it was. Some of them asked about jobs on the Eli Reynolds, Captain. But of course she's all full up, so I had to let them go. I hope I done right. You weren't here, of course, nor Mr. Jeffers, and I thought maybe you was both dead, so I couldn't get no instructions."
"Never mind about that," Marsh said.
The news heartened him somewhat. If Julian and his pack had taken over Marsh's steamer, at least some of his crew had gotten clear.
"Who was here?"
"Why, I saw Jack Eli, the second engineer, and some waiters, and a couple of your strikers. Sam Klein and Sam Thompson, it was.
There was a few others. Any of them still around?
Green shrugged.
When I didn't hire them, they weren't looking around other boats, Captain. I don't know.
Damn, Marsh said.
Wait, the agent said, raising a finger. I know. Mr. Albright, the pilot. He was one of them told me about the fever. He was here about 4 days ago, and he didn't want no job. He's a lower river pilot, you know. So the Eli Reynolds wasn't for him. He said he was taking a room at the Planter's house until he could find a position on one of the classier boats, a big side-wheeler like. Albright, eh? Marsh said. What about Kyle Fram? You see him?
If Fram and Albright had both left the fever dream, the steamer shouldn't be hard to find. Without qualified pilots, she couldn't move.
But Green shook his head.
No, ain't seen Mr. Fram.
Marsh's hopes sank. If Carl Fram was still aboard her, the fever dream could be anywhere along the river. She might have gone off any one of a number of tributaries. Or maybe the fever dream had even steamed back down to New Orleans while he was laid up in that woodyard south of Bayou Sarah. I'm going to pay a call on Dan Albright, he told the agent. While I'm gone, I want you to write some letters to agents, pilots, anybody you know along the river from here to New Orleans. Ask about the fever dream. Somebody has got to have seen her. Steamer like that don't just vanish. You write those letters up this afternoon, you hear, and get down to the landing and post them on the fastest boats you see. I aim to find my steamer.
Yes, sir, the agent said. He got out a stack of paper and a pen, dipped it in the inkwell, and began to write.
The clerk at the Planter's house desk bobbed his head in greeting.
Why, it's Captain Marsh, he said. Heard about your misfortune, just awful. Ron's John's a wicked one. That he is. I'm glad you're better, Captain, I truly am.
Never mind about that, Marsh said, annoyed. What room is Dan Albright in? Albright had been polishing his boots. He let Marsh in with a cool, polite nod of greeting, took his seat again, stuck an arm into one boot, and resumed shining, as if he'd never been called to the door. Abner Marsh sat down heavily and wasted no time with pleasantries.
"Why'd you leave the fever dream?" he asked bluntly.
"Fever, Captain," Albright said. He studied Marsh briefly, then went